You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @PolicyPodcasts.
I'm David Wessel. I'm director of the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy here at Brookings. And on behalf of my colleagues here at Brookings and the Washington University's Olin School of Business and the Brandeis International Business School's Rosenberg Institute of Global Finance and the Center for Municipal Finance at the University of Chicago Harris Public Policy School, I'd like to welcome you all to what is the 6th Annual Municipal Finance Conference, the second one that we've had the honor of hosting here at Brookings. As many of you know, the mission of this conference is to bring together scholars and market practitioners and public officials, both on the issuer and the regulatory side, to improve the quality of research in municipal capital markets and state and local fiscal policies in general, and to ultimately improve the quality of public policy. The goal of all our efforts ought to be to make America a better place and make it easier for us, for our state and local governments to function on the behalf of their constituents. I just want to explain to you a little bit about the logistics of today. We're going to start, and I'll introduce the panel in a moment, the speaker in a moment. We're going to start in this room. We'll have a break at 2:30, and then we'll divide into two sessions. We've kind of conceived them roughly, one more on state and local fiscal and economic issues and one on more muni capital issues. In this room, the Falk Auditorium, we'll have the papers by Boyd and Yin, Schoag and Farrell and Boylan on pension plans and the impact of the Voting Rights Act on municipal reform and pensions. In the Saul Zilker Room, which is just on the other side of the coffee pots there, we'll have a session on Andy Calate's paper on a yield curve and Dario Sestao's paper on negotiated sales restrictions of school district bonds, a natural experiment. And Komla of SUNY Binghamton, you'll have to get him to pronounce the last name, on some of the impact of regulatory disclosure interventions in the secondary market. At the end of the breakout sessions, which should be around 4:45, we're going to move to the Capitol Hilton, which is a few blocks away. We'll have drinks for about an hour and 15 minutes, and then we'll convene for dinner at 6:30. If you don't feel like walking in their tropical conditions in Washington, we're going to have a van at the front door here that'll take you to the hotel, and it'll make multiple trips. The same thing will happen in reverse in the morning. We're very pleased tonight at dinner that after we have our drinks and our first and second courses, we'll be joined by Mayor Kasim Reed of Atlanta. More on that later. My colleagues from Brookings around the registration desk, or you'll get to know who they are, can help you with any logistical issues. There are instructions in your folder about using the internet, the Wi-Fi. The bathrooms are right back there, and our maintenance staff would greatly appreciate it if you have a cup of coffee or papers at your seat, that you put them in the garbage cans when you leave. We decided not to print out copies of the papers. It just seems inefficient. They're all posted online already, and if you need one, a copy for any particular reason for a discussion or something, just let us know and we can put that out. The entire conference is on the record. This session this morning, the paper and the panel discussion will be live streamed, as will the panel at the end of the program tonight, tomorrow on public investment. We will be videoing the conversation with Kasim Reed tonight at the Capitol Hilton. We'll put that up sometime later. It's not practical to live stream off-site. It's a big group, which is very heartening. It sometimes makes it hard to have a dialogue. But we're going to allow time for questions at every session, and we really encourage you to participate, because one of the points of this conference is to bring together people who have different perspectives on the same thing, whether it's from the regulatory side, the issuer side, the market side, or the investor side, or the academic side. And so as much as possible, we hope you'll all participate. I think it was a great, really appreciate that Dan Bergstresser of Brandeis and Martin Luby of the UT Austin agreed to pull together an enormous amount of data to shed some light on how the municipal capital markets have changed since the Great Recession, which it's been almost a decade now since the beginning of the financial crisis. It seems almost like yesterday in some respects. So what's going to happen is Dan is going to present. He has some slides, which will be on our website. And then Rich Reifel from WashU will come up and introduce a panel that will be up here to discuss this issue, which is really pretty wide-ranging. Dan and Martin have pulled together an enormous amount of data, and we're going to look for a good way to make that publicly available in case other people are interested in doing research on the questions that they raise in their paper. They've really, I think, skimmed the surface, but it's an incredibly important surface to skim. So with that, I turn the panel over, the mic over to Dan Bergstresser.
All right. Can you guys hear me in the back? Can you guys hear me okay? So first of all, I want to say a sincere thanks to Brookings, to Brandeis, and to UT for providing the support that was involved in acquiring some of the data for this paper. And thanks to the MSRB, which provided the trading data that we have. And this work is co-authored with Marty Luby, who's a professor at the University of Texas. Our goal here is to be systematic about thinking about the changes that have happened in the muni market, both in the primary market and the secondary market, over the period between 2000 and 2016. So the period before the crisis, the period during the crisis, and the recovery from the crisis, which continues. The tables that we have, it's actually kind of a subset of the total number of tables that we've created. They're up on the website, so as I go through the presentation, you might see a table number if you're following along in the table deck that's on the website. That is a pointer to the table number in that presentation. We're going to focus on 10 things. So the sources of the data are Mergent, which is a provider of fixed income attributes and characteristics, recently acquired by the London Stock Exchange, the MSRB, and also for some deep analysis of Texas, we got data from the Texas Bond Review Board. I will say that one thing that Marty and I did a lot of work, you know, we did some stuff that is really smart, we did some stuff that is really stupid. The really smart thing that we did, the way in which we dove deep, was if you go to the Mergent data, the identification of underwriters, the identification of financial advisors is good but messy, right? In the sense that they will, you know, they'll have eight different things that they call JP Morgan or eight different things that they call sort of the same bank. And so we did a lot of work to create consistent mappings that allow us to identify consistently who the underwriters are, who the financial advisors are. And that's something that we want to share with the community because I think as you do research, it's important to have access to you know, high quality. And certainly if you find errors in what we've done, then let us know. This is a process that we hope will be iterative. The thing that we've done that I think, you know, where we're not at the frontier of what you can do scientifically is we're going to do some very simple comparisons, right? We're going to compare, you know, measures of spread in the negotiated competitive underwritings. You know, if you want to assign a causal interpretation to the differences that you find there, you'd really want to do something clinical, right? You want to do a controlled, you know, double-blind clinical trial. We're very humble about what we're doing in this analysis. We've got the data right, but in terms of the actual analysis, you know, we're showing correlations, and we're not necessarily taking a causal interpretation to everything that we're finding, right? So the first thing that we want to show and the first thing we want to express is a lot of academics, at least, don't appreciate the extent to which the market has changed since the crisis in terms of the issuance. The issuance recently has been tilting way in the direction of refinancing, refunding existing bond issues. The new issue category is one that is declining in significance in a way that is really remarkable. The decline in sort of new money bond issuance has outpaced the decline in infrastructure investment. Right? If you look at how fast infrastructure investment is declining, it's declining, but it's declining more slowly than the new money bond issuance. What's going on is that you're seeing increasing reliance on bank finance. Going forward, you're going to see increasing reliance on P3s, right? We think that this is creating conditions that it's worth being aware of, right? In the sense that we're not confident that we're not confident that there's total transparency about the risks that issuers are taking on when it comes to borrowing directly from banks, when it comes to P3s. And so one thing is, as people who study the municipal bond market, one emerging risk that we see in that market that in some ways mirrors the risks that built up leading up to the financial crisis, where you have risks in the context of bond issues, but it's the combination of variable rate issuance combined with swaps that created the potential for surprising realizations of existing risks. We think that there's also cause for concern now in terms of the increasing reliance on bank finance and the potential that issuers are taking risks in terms of, you know, acceleration, in terms of the terms of those bank financings that are not appreciated. If you look at the type of coupon, you know, this is the dark blue is fixed rate, the light blue is variable rate. You see the kind of the peak in the variable rate market. And you know, what we should say is that this was by and large variable rate bond issuance that was happening in the context of a synthetic fixed structure. So this is not actually taking a net variable rate exposure. This is a variable rate, you know, an auction rate security combined with a swap. So the net exposure was, you know, in principle, the net exposure was a fixed rate exposure, you know, with some basis risk, which had the potential to materialize. Right. So this is the way in which the market has changed. You see the collapse in variable rate issuance. You know, the structures, the variable rate structures of the period between 2005 and 2007. Embedded a variety of risks for the issuers, you know, and we think the MSRB is on top of this, but this is something that is, as professors, we feel like the entire community needs to be aggressive about making sure that the principles of transparency and disclosure are you know, articulated again and again. So when it comes to getting into the nuts and bolts of the structure, I think this is an important graph because it highlights the way in which the market has really changed. If you look at the weighted average maturity of bond issuance 2000 to 2016, it's gone down to 13 and a half years is the weighted average maturity. What that means, you know, given that most of the issuance, even when you were seeing a lot of variable rate issuance, was synthetic fixed, what that means is that if we do transition to a higher interest rate environment, the pace at which that gets passed through to budgets will be more rapid than it would have been if you had a maturity structure with sort of longer maturities. Right, now we start getting into the nuts and bolts of the primary market. What we're doing here is we're combining data on the bond characteristics with data on the trading of the bond in the first 30 days post-issuance. So we're looking specifically at a measure of the efficiency with which the primary market works, which is the spread between the price realized by the issuer and the price at which the bonds are sold to the customers in the first 30 days post-issuance. Two things I think are important to see in this chart. This is something that academics have focused on quite a lot, this measure of the efficiency with which the primary market works. Right? So if you see an issuer getting 95 cents, or if you see an issuer getting a dollar for a bond that a customer turns around and buys for, you know, $1.10 20 days later, you know, certainly that could reflect you know, the cost of intermediation. But issuers have some justification for feeling that, like, that's potentially a rent that is being captured by the dealer community. What you see when you look at the numbers, when you look at that spread, is that it really matters a lot whether you weight by the bond issued or you weight by the dollar of issuance, right? So the dark line here is the average spread in the primary market weighted by the dollar amount issued. And the light blue is weighted by the bond, right? So that the average bond at the bottom, can you guys see the bottom row? Is it blocked by the, I'll just push the tables over. Actually on the bottom row, you see, there you go. Right, okay. Bottom row you see not weighted by bond size, it's just sort of weighted by bond. You see that the average spread in the primary market is in the neighborhood of 18 basis points, 20 basis points during the crisis, which we define as 2008 to 2010. That's not like a scientific definition, but we separately identify 2008 to 2007 to 2010. And the thing that really jumps out about that 2008 to 2010 period is that during that period, if you weight by the size of the bond, actually the spreads are higher, right? So if you look most of the time, the analysis that has been done of the spreads in the primary market has kind of looked at the average bond where the spreads are pretty high. We think there is some utility to looking at the average dollar of issuance, which tells you sort of, you know, what is the dollar amount of spread in the, you know, whether it's compensation for the real cost of underwriting, you know, whatever that is. We think it's important to focus on dollar amounts. And the dollar amounts are actually much lower than you would think just from looking at the average bond. Right, the larger bonds are from this analysis cheaper to intermediate, except during the crisis where the cost of the larger bonds went up, and so that's a pattern that is I think worth knowing about. 2009, 2010 is pretty unusual. The larger bonds appear to have more primary market underwriting. Right, so here's where we're saying I think appropriately academic research has been positively influenced by the need to really nail down causation. You know, what actually causes a phenomenon? We're just saying with this graph, we're just saying damn the torpedoes, just straight ahead, just simple means, right? What is the average spread competitive sale process? What is the average spread negotiated? And so we cannot assign a causal interpretation to this. This is just a correlation. But what you see is that the bonds that are sold through the competitive process, the simple average spread in the primary market is about half, depending on the time period, which you see in the negotiated bonds that are sold through the negotiated process. Right? And this is, if you kind of look at the spread over time, between the spread in the spread, right? So comparing the spread, the this is the differential between the spread and the bonds sold through the negotiated process and the competitive. You see it kind of peaks during the crisis and then comes back down. Right? Then we start trying to really kind of make enemies here. We actually cut it by the size of the underwriter, right? And you know, in principle, you could sort of boil it down to the specific identity of the underwriter if you wanted, but we didn't want to make enemies who are that specific. So we just broke it into small underwriter and large underwriter, right? And again, not assigning a causal interpretation, like this is just a simple correlation. And if you look at the spreads, there's a little bit of a wedge where the bonds that are underwritten by large underwriters, it looks like there's a lower spread than the bonds that are underwritten by smaller underwriters. And we can do similar analysis that we do in the tables. You know, don't have slides in the slide deck, but you can look by the size of the financial advisor. Are you using a large financial advisor or a small financial advisor? We also, for the bonds that are issued in Texas, the Texas Bond Review Board collects information on the explicit costs of issuance, and you can look at the relationship between the explicit costs of issuance and then this implicit cost coming from the spread. And it looks like the bonds where the explicit costs are higher, you actually see somewhat lower spreads, right? So if you pay a lot in terms of explicit costs in the context of underwriting, those bond issues are associated with sort of with smaller spreads in the primary market. And so this is by underwriter size, kind of an interesting phenomenon. We again, this is all correlations, but we do if you compare the two rows, there's kind of a gross differential in the spread between the small underwriter underwritten bonds and the large underwriter underwritten bonds, and the top line is just the gross differential in the spreads. Then we try to control for the characteristics of the bond. We say, you know, what's the purpose of the bond? What's the size of the bond? You know, a variety of different characteristics. And when you control for those characteristics, instead of getting smaller, the differential actually gets bigger, right? So it looks like controlling for the characteristics of the bond actually appears to make the spread between the spread in the primary market look bigger. Okay, so what's the upshot? It appears that the bonds that are underwritten via smaller underwriters, you see a greater spread, and the relative underpricing gets greater when you control for the bond's characteristics. Another phenomenon that we don't think, you know, Eric Seary did a really good report for the MSRB a couple of years ago, where he focused on, you know, any pattern of sale to a dealer followed by a sale back to a customer, it's really interesting to track what's going on with the inter-dealer trades, right, in that process. If you think of the entire intermediation, you know, I'm an issuer, I sell a bond to an underwriter, that underwriter may sell a bond to a different underwriter, you know, to a different dealer, maybe it goes to a different dealer, and then it ends up in the hands of a final customer. One thing that Marty and I are finding as we kind of torture the data is that if you look, and the blue line is the mean, right? So walk that across to the right-hand side. The number of inter-dealer trades in the context of this primary market went way up between 2000 and 2009. And you're seeing the bonds go through more hands in the primary market. Then it kind of comes down after the financial crisis. You see the spike in the financial crisis where between 2007 and 2008, all of a sudden, you know, underwriting a bond is associated with, you know, just many more inter-dealer trades. There's something that's changing about the way in which the market is working during the crisis, where you're seeing sort of a more rapid intermediation or a more intricate intermediation, right? And then it eases off, and since it's come back, you never want to say anything's permanent, but there appears to have been kind of a regime change where the number of trades that you're seeing in the context of a new issuance, it's a more intricate, more involved process, potentially because of a reduction in the cost of doing each individual trade. Right. So what's the upshot? There seems to be sort of a stable change in the regime, where the average number of interdealer trades in the primary market has gone from around 2 to around 4. Right. Now we start looking at transactions costs in the secondary market. So these are seasoned bonds. And this analysis follows pretty closely the work that Eric Seary has done in his report for the MSRB. Again, trying to think very, very hard about identifying packages of trades in the MSRB data that add up to effectively one transaction, right? So if you see a dealer buy $1 million worth of bonds from a customer, and then you see like 8 interdealer trades where the bonds are sort of going from dealer to dealer, and then it gets broken up into, you know, 4 sales to customer, each worth $250,000, we bundle that together effectively into one round trip transaction. There is you know, the phenomenon of taking, you know, buying $1 million and then breaking it up into, you know, a bunch of different sort of smaller blocks is in some sense the exercise of an option, because it's hard to kind of put that back together. And once you have a small block, it's potentially, as you'll see, it's more expensive to trade that small block. But this is what we see in the spread in the secondary market trades. And what you notice, the blue line is for small trades, right? We define as less than $1 million. Right. The light blue line is for large trades, which we define as trades where the par value, it's a par value that we're using to cut it, greater than $1 million. The price of transacting in terms of, you know, in small transactions is, it comes down, right, around the time that you have a real-time reporting, and it goes back up during the financial crisis. So that's a 2% is the average round-trip transaction, average transaction cost. And then it's come way down. It's about half what it was in 2000. If you compare the cost of doing a small bond trade today, it's half what it was in 2000. If you look at the large transactions, right, the average spread on the large transactions between 2000 and 2007 was less than 10 basis points in that period, and now it's almost 20 basis points. And so if you ask the question, is it more or less expensive to transact today in a secondary market trade in the muni market than it was 10 years ago, it depends really very much on whether you're a large trader or a small trader. For the small traders, it's become less expensive. For the large traders, it's become more expensive. And the last piece of analysis that I'll talk about before ceding to the discussants, this is the upshot. Large trades become more expensive 2007 to 2009, and it's not a blip. Like a lot of changes that you see during the crisis, you see that sort of something strange happened during the crisis, and then we go back to normal. That's not the case here. It seems to be a permanent regime change, right? This is the number of inter-dealer trades, right, in the context of any, you know, the average secondary market transaction, and you're seeing the same phenomenon that the dealer buys from a customer, sells back to a customer. for the average trade in 2000, you saw 0.39 interdealer trades in the context of intermediation. Now it's almost 1.4. So you're seeing a lot more activity for the same final customer solution, which is, you know, buying a bond and selling it back to a customer. You're seeing a lot more activity. And, you know, that could potentially reflect the fact that it's cheaper to do the activity. Like, anytime something gets cheaper to do, you're going to see a little bit more of it. But you are seeing this phenomenon that the interdealer market is becoming more active, at least by this measure. We think this is going to matter because as we transition to a regime where markups are disclosed to customers, one of the phenomena that is going to be important to pay attention to is what are the details of how the markup, you know, how and when the markup has to get disclosed, right? So if I buy, you know, if Colin sells me $1 million worth of bonds and I turn around and sell them immediately to Marty, like, that's very clearly something where I would, you know, based on the my understanding of how the rulemaking will work, I would have to report that the markup will be transparent. But if I pass it around, you know, from dealer to dealer for a while, potentially over, you know, a couple of days, I might have accomplished the same underlying economic objective, but you can imagine that being handled differently in terms of reporting the markup to the clients. And so that's something to pay attention to. So if you take away one, you know, if you take away 10 things from our analysis, if you take the market is changing. I think a key way in which the market has changed, and this is something that I think George Friedlander has highlighted, people are aware of this, is that we have to maintain our understanding of the distinction between financing and funding, right? So the decline in new money bond issuance is much more rapid than the decline in infrastructure spending. So the money is coming from somewhere. It's banks. It will be P3s. That will have implications for the credit experience of bond investors. Like, I really want to know, you know, what are the terms of the bank loans that issuers are taking on, you know, or the way in which risk is shared in the context of a P3 that they're doing. And so we think it's a priority for the academic community to maintain the focus on transparency in this changing world. Issuance and trading costs increase in the 2007 to 2009 period. The extent to which it's kind of gone back depends on exactly how you slice the data. When it comes to large trades, those appear now to have become permanently more expensive. The small trades are now cheaper than they were. In both cases, trading is becoming, and this is not a scientific term, but trading is kind of becoming more intricate. Like, you're seeing the same, serving the customers in the same way is just involving a lot more steps. You're seeing the bonds pass through more hands, and that's going to have implications for how the regulators think about disclosing, you know, among other things, disclosing markup on transactions. So it's worth keeping an eye on. So thanks very much for your attention. And Rich, would you like me to just sit here? All right.
Thanks, Dan. Again, I'm Rich Reifel. I'm with Washington University in St. Louis, one of the conference co-chairs. I want to invite the panel one by one to come on up, starting first with Marty Luby from UT Austin, who is Dan's co-author on this. Natalie.
Marty will rebut.
Marty will now disagree with everything Dan said. Natalie Cohen from Wells Fargo. Brad Wendt from Charles River Associates, and Colin McNaught from BondLink. All of their resumes are in your packets, so I'm going to forego any more in-depth introduction of them. So Dan and Marty accepted our challenge to put together some great data that we could all chew on, and all of these slides, as you know, all of their charts are on the conference website, and this panel's task is to try to distill some of that information down from 27 charts to the 10 themes that Dan talked about to three main themes that we're going to discuss up here, and then we'll open it to some questions from the audience. We are on a bit of a time constraint, so we'll be somewhat brief in touching each of these points. Before we start, I wanted to just make a few observations, because I think this is the first time that any sort of wide-ranging data analysis has been done before and after the crisis. So I think this is going to be great great fodder for academics moving forward. But I had a number of observations that I just sort of made anecdotally before and after, and I wanted to toss those into the mix with no backing other than my own observations and opinion. So I think we're at a bit of an inflection point now that we're almost fully 10 years after the crisis. So we had a period of very low interest rates. Those are now beginning to change. We had a period of enhanced regulation, perhaps with the new administration and some revisions to the regulatory environment. That's going to change. We had a severe reduction in the use of bond insurance. That's beginning to change. We had a lot of private placements and a lot of private transactions being done. I think now, as Dan just pointed out, as some of the risks in those transactions are being known, perhaps that trend is going to reverse itself. We had a period of very high innovation before the crisis. A lot of the synthetic debt that Dan referenced was an example of that. Then we had that innovation in the headlines, so that lowered innovation. And I think as memories recede and risk gets repriced, we might see more innovation. That coupled with some of the potential administrative proposals around infrastructure and P3 and that sort of thing might encourage some more innovation. So I'm looking forward to the discussion to see how perhaps the data could be used to inform policy moving forward as we are at this inflection point. So
we do need to. All right. So the first theme that we wanted to talk about is we had this this great data on coupon type, fixed versus floating, and all of our panelists have some pretty strong informed views on why that might be the case. So I'll just start perhaps with Colin.
On why that's the case or the implications?
On the implications.
And
yeah.
Okay, sorry.
And do you think that likely to continue given that we're in a rising interest rate environment?
Yeah, on the one hand, it's a good sign, right? You're seeing that governments are taking advantage of shorter, lower long-term interest rates. They're issuing more fixed rate bonds than maybe they normally would. They're saving capacity to issue variable rates when the yield curve steepens. That's a really good thing as well. I think the concern would be if issuers are not focused across the balance sheet and looking at interest rate risk that is on the investment side as well as in their pension funds. So debt is not managed or issued in a vacuum. It's one single government. You know, I was with the state of Massachusetts. I was issuing in my silo, but we had to manage billions of dollars in short-term cash and $50 billion in pension assets. So every decision I made in terms of interest rate risk had some sort of risk impact across the balance sheet. And while I thought issuing fixed rate bonds was conservative across the balance sheet, that was the exact opposite. So my observation is, a lot of fixed rate issuance, it may be a good thing on the one hand, if governments are not realizing that they are positioning their balance sheet in a very, very specific way. Their balance sheets will not do well in a declining interest rate environment if everything is fixed on the debt side. And that's a concern. I think from my own practical experience, I was a little bit of a variable rate junkie. I liked variable rate. I liked floating rate, particularly plain vanilla structures. I think Dan and Marty pointed out that some really obtuse and opaque structures were used in the past and used heavily, whether it's auction rate securities or VRDBs or swaps. If those have gone away, it's a very good thing. If they're being replaced by something else, it's in the market's interest to discover what those new structures are. Are they bank loans? Are they direct placement? But going back to the initial point, fixed versus floating, there's a lot of capacity in the market to do more floating rate. There's so much supply coming on the long end in the form of fixed rate bonds that will have an impact or is having an impact on prices for issuers.
I think that's it. Topic that's been the case on the federal level as well of late. Brad, do you want to add to that?
Certainly. I think it's probably time that municipal issuers jump back in the pond, and we were all around for the carnage in the LOC and the Dutch auction market, which correctly scared the heck out of everyone. Our left bookend is the fiscal crisis. But after seeing some of these excellent slides, I said, well, that's strange. I'm not sure if the slide was up there, but as recently as last year, I think the ratio was 90 to 10 in terms of fixed rate bonds versus floaters. And I said, well, let's just take a look at where the SIFMA index traded for the last decade. And you don't have to squint. It was certainly under 50 basis points, half a percent. So as you've just pointed out, if you're not taking advantage of that, and for your operating cash from a policy perspective, you're earning half a percent or 0.75%, you are just grossly mismatched. So if we try to say, why is this happening? Everyone still has the scars, the bruises of the failed auctions and everything else. The LOCs are, once again, banks are healthy. They're back in the marketplace, as just pointed out. And my comment is, I think from a policy perspective, issuers really have to take a look at their fixed and floating mix, because when you can start paying all in at 0.5% for your capital, certainly you don't want your whole portfolio in that realm, but certainly some percentages, more than 10%, is very reasonable, in my opinion.
Natalie?
So I think the mission now to take this amazing data that you've put out there is to try to separate what's, as you put it, Dan, a blip, versus what's an enduring trend. And in terms of the variable rate, I think a lot of, at one point, the market, you're touching on the apex between regulation of banks, regulation of the bond insurance business, and regulation of the securities market. And what was happening was there was this huge issuance taking advantage of the curve of tender option bonds. And they were supported by bond insurance on the long end, and therefore cost less capital for banks to use the bond insurance and create these types of structures. So I think the question is, the unwind of that obviously created a big anomaly, which was throwing a lot of long-dated paper on the market, and you can chart sort of what happened during that. As you have, you can chart the process of what happened during that time period with pricing on the longer-dated paper. Is that going to reoccur? I don't think so. It may take a different shape. There may be some other product. But I think that as one of the other speakers pointed out, most of us, including issuers, have been extremely chastened by what happened then. So I think that's really the effort all across the board, understanding what in this data is a single anomaly. We also, and we'll probably get to this, but if you look through the charts, that 2009-10 period was Build America bonds. Build America bonds were non-callable, long-dated, and what that did was it squeezed the tax-exempt market into the shorter end. Sorry, I always talk with my hands and I tend to hit the microphone. We're short-dated on the tax-exempt side. And so I think that if you look at your charts during those time periods, that might get you to a little bit of the why things gapped out at that point. So again, BABs non-callable, long-dated, and also large in size to attract corporate investors because they were taxable. So to attract and give the impression that there was greater liquidity in those instruments, they were larger deals. So I think you had a distortion at that point in time. Again, is the question longer versus a long blip, or is that a one-time blip that we may not see again?
I'm going to move on to our second topic, a favorite of mine, underpricing as a, yeah, Dan?
My microphone, can I say one?
Yeah, please.
I want to just reinforce what Colin said. You know, if you look at any issuer that's making a decision about what mix of variable rate and fixed rate debt to have, that risk exposure is dwarfed in a long run sense by the exposure in their pension plan. It's just orders of magnitude different. Now, it may not
you know, you can defer the the counting may make it a context where you can defer the recognition of losses, but the reality is there. I think the other thing that strikes me is that if I'm an investor in the municipal bond market, it seems to me like the biggest risk that I face is the pension risk. I mean, depending on where you're investing in it. And it seems like as a community getting more aggressive about influencing the asset allocation of pension plans is not a totally crazy thing to contemplate, because the you know, you look at a pension plan, it's almost like a gambler at the table. Like there's somebody sitting there at the table and they're gambling with resources. You know, how that works is gonna affect whether or not the resources are there to pay back the municipal bonds. And I think as a community, the bond community, rather than sort of parachuting in once the default has happened or once the crisis has hit, getting more aggressive about looking 15 years out, looking 20 years out and saying, hey, what place is okay if they step back from the table today? Right. What are the places that if they step back from the table and tilt their asset allocation in a way that means, you know, it might hurt them right today, but it means we get paid. That's not a crazy thing to think about coming together to do as a community.
If I could just make one comment related to Brad's comment about getting back in the water with variable rate debt. I think it's incumbent on the academic community to chime in on this issue, which is that if issuers had issued a lot more naked variable rate debt in the period, you know, before the crisis and even after, there's significant savings, and you would have realized significant savings over the last 15 years. A lot of the debate, a lot of the discussion, is anecdotal. So I think it'd be a worthwhile endeavor for academics to look back and show, you know, some kind of non-biased analytical. And offer some non-biased analytical analyses to show what the opportunity cost has been not to have more variable rate exposure in your portfolios.
And speaking of a topic that would make a lot of enemies. So in the interest of time, this may be our second one. We may then open it to the audience. So I'm going to reserve the right to call an audible on that. But underpricing is a favorite topic of mine because I was an investment banker and never underpriced an issue. So I was interested to see some of the data. I'm curious what the panelists think about that. Colin, you want to start?
Yeah.
You were an issuer, always right on market.
Yeah, not sure why I'm going first all the time.
You're next to me.
So really interesting data. I mean, it's not easy to interpret. Some uptick in prices are probably expected or inevitable. But how much is due to the natural supply and demand? There's more demand for bonds. There's more demand than there's access to bonds. In Marty and Dan's data, it was 17 basis points. That's a lot. On a market of $450 billion in bonds, that's billions of dollars of mispricing. I don't know what the right answer is. I mean, it would be worth looking at how bonds break in the secondary in the corporate bond market. I don't think we have that data, or it's not easily accessible. Just to get a thumbnail comparison, are we doing things right? But that should be a big area of focus. That's literally billions of dollars of mispricing.
Brad?
I think it might be helpful for the audience, if Marty or Dan, you just frame what that 17 basis points is. We've been... You know, looking at the data, why don't you just set the stage what we mean by that 17 basis points of mispricing?
Yeah, we're talking about the spread between the price that the issuer gets for the bonds and the price at which the bonds eventually land in the immediate trades in the 30 days post issuance. And so if you see an issuer getting $100 for the bonds, and then a week later a customer buys it for $102, that's a 2% spread between what the issuer got and the price at which it was sold to the final customer. I will say, and pushing back a little bit on Colin, it's not 100% obvious that that is a rent,
right? That rent in the sense of extraction of value by the underwriter community. That could be. And this is there's a nice paper by Paul Schultz at Notre Dame where he shows some evidence that's consistent with that markup reflecting the real cost of intermediation. Like it costs it uses resources to break a bond issue in pieces and sell them to retail investors, and it takes some it takes some science to determine okay when is it excessive and when is it not excessive. And the other thing that Marty and I like not we're not I'm perfectly capable of criticizing the underwriter community. Like I'm not sort of in bed with underwriters, but also it matters whether you look at the average bond or the average dollar of bond issuance. And I think the 17 basis points is the average bond. If you look at the average dollar of issuance, the larger you issues are, you're seeing a smaller spread. And so the dollar total, you have to be careful. You have to be careful, whether you're talking about the average bond, which matters. I mean, small issuers matter. But when you're thinking about the aggregate dollar totals, you have to be careful.
So I just wanted to make a comment on that. I don't think you can overestimate the loss, the effect of the loss of bond insurance, because what that did at almost 60% of the new issue market at its peak, it was a different market in the sense that a small issuer could sell nationally if they had bond insurance. So they were able to take a small school district that might have priced completely differently absent bond insurance and sell it into a portfolio, a mutual fund that was AAA or whatever. So the friction that was created after that, I think, needs to be taken into account, and maybe that is an ongoing blip and does relate to large versus small dealers. Just a thought.
Brad, did you want to add to that?
The symmetry of the data is exactly what Natalie just said, where the spread was larger for the smaller issues, and that simply makes sense. But I agree with you. I think we could really argue both sides whether there's rents there.
Certainly also an issue that the regulators are looking at very closely. So I do want to try to get the audience involved. So if we have a question, I'll take back the gentleman in the back there. So I think we have a microphone coming by, if you could wait for that. Thank you.
Hi, Tom Metzold, retired former portfolio manager in the municipal bond market. And there's a simple calculation that nobody's doing. Let's just round up 17 basis points to 20 basis points and call it 2%. On $100,000, that's $2,000 that the buyer, the retail investor, buys one time, holds it to maturity, and pays a total of $2,000 until that bond matures and they reinvest. Supposedly, the institutions, of which I used to be one, and I'm arguing against the so-called model that it's better to go with managed money, if they take that same $100,000 and they have zero markup, they're getting it at 0%, but they're charging 50 basis points a year for 10 years, that's 5%. They've paid more and gotten less over the same 10-year period, and nobody talks about that. So, yeah, there's the cost of infrastructure, because the simple point is, with 1.3 million CUSIPs, this is not the equity market or the corporate bond market. It's the simple cost of doing business, and it's actually better for the buy-and-hold investor.
So, Marty or Dan, do you want to comment on that? Do you have a...
I think there's a lot of truth there. If you're looking at the total expense package that is paid by an investor, if they're investing through a mutual fund, that mutual fund might be transacting in large blocks, and so they're not paying on the transactions that the fund is doing, they're not paying as much, but the investor is paying a management fee to the mutual fund. Now, I think a small number of investors actually invest directly without using a separately managed account. So in the flow of funds data, household, the bucket that's household, first of all, it's calculated as a residual, so we don't know exactly. But also a lot of that money is separately managed account money, and so they are paying, there is some kind of fee is being paid, but understanding the total fee and expense structure that investors realize is an important topic.
I suppose that could be an interesting point for the DOL rule as well. What's really the in the best interest to ladder or manage money? Nancy?
Hi. I have a question and then a comment. The question I have is with respect to the analysis that you referred to in the earlier part of your presentation, when you said that you tested for all characteristics of the bonds, did you separate credit quality? And because I would imagine there would be substantial difference in high-grade paper versus lower-grade paper, and that, you know, the panelists have addressed it, particularly Natalie, with regard to speaking to the absence of bond insurance, but just the underlying large issuers with high credit ratings have very different costs of intermediation than small issuers.
Yep. So I'll answer that question honestly and somewhat nervously. We made like 100 tables for this presentation, and some we did and some we didn't, and I actually don't remember what went into this.
I think it's
important. One issue that we have with controlling for the credit quality, and I'll get into the weeds of the data a little bit. We also use data from S&P for the credit rating. If you're using the Mergent data, and I love Mergent, you know, we use their data, but the thing they do that makes me filled with rage is that they, at the moment, they only their credit ratings are a point in time, today, right? So you might have you'd like to know the rating of the bond when it was issued, but in the Mergent database, if you go by the database, you have the rating as of today, which is not what you want to if you're studying the primary market. And so we have the S&P data on ratings through 2014, and then we sort of carry forward the last rating in 2014. So we have those data. We've made tables with those data, and I'm totally blanking, or just to be honest, like on what went into this presentation. But we'll share that with you.
Okay, thanks. And the comment I was going to make was I used to be a bond issuer, and before that I was a financial advisor at a big financial advisory firm who did this exact kind of analysis for clients before we advised them on the price they should expect for the sale of their bonds. And as an issuer, what I found was having that granular data and then telling the underwriter that we would evaluate the underwriter's performance based on the secondary market trading that occurred in the 30 days after the sale, and that underwriters who priced the bonds and put them away and had very smaller differences in price were rewarded with additional business.
I wanted to make just one comment about that previous question, and maybe Colin could touch on this a little bit, but that this total cost of ownership of a municipal bond from an investor standpoint, a retail investor standpoint, I've long been amazed that issuers haven't been more active in taking advantage of what's a de facto arbitrage there to go directly to the retail market and capture that 20 and save the 50 and issue directly to that market. And I know, Colin, you did some of that in issuing directly at the state of Mass. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, we tried. It's not easy. So we had created a program, a six-month program, where we sold bonds almost every day using an electronic trading platform and really let the market determine how many bonds they wanted to buy. We weren't coming to the market with 100 million and trying to oversaturate the market. We let the market demand determine what we were selling every day. It was a way for us to normalize our prices. It was a way for us to normalize our spreads. It was a little bit like dollar cost averaging in the reverse direction. And the response was phenomenal. Individuals were still not buying directly from the state of Massachusetts. We were not a broker dealer. So they were still using an advisor, but we were able to sell $6 million a day, every day for 6 months. And had a remarkable effect on our spreads. And it's not easy to get to retail. There's a lot of market conventions that make it difficult to sell to retail. Typically, when an issuer comes to market, there's a week's notice to the market. So by the time an individual hears about a bond sale, it could be too late, or they're not ready to sell. And then the sale date is typically one day, or maybe it's 2 days. You could be traveling. You can't get a hold of your broker. He's on vacation. All these things add up. You know, it's easier to order a book on Amazon than it is to order a bond. So when we had this trading platform, we achieved straight-through processing. So if a bond was available to an investor, you would get a confirmation that same day that you were going to get that bond. That was groundbreaking. That took 6 months for us to develop. But Amazon developed it years ago, or whoever else. So there's a lot of things. There's a lot of work left to do in connecting retail directly to issuers. And I think it's a sort of unmined, untapped territory.
So this is this topic we're dealing with is huge. That's the good thing. The bad thing is we're short on time. So we're going to, I'll take one more question if we have one. No more questions, so I'm going to let Dan have our final comment here.
The one thing for researchers to be aware of, I think the acquisition of Mergent, which all the folks doing research use by the LSE, is going to be consequential for us. And I have detected, as I communicate with them, they seem very responsive to things that we're interested in, and they also seem very interested in charging us money. So, like, my conversation with them about the point in time ratings, like the historical database on ratings, in the past, they with questions like that, they have seemed less interested. They seem very interested now, and they say, "Oh, yeah, we'll put that together, and we'll find a way to charge you more money for it." So the world is going to be different in terms of research. Whether that's better or worse is hard to say. It kind of depends on how big your research budget is. So,
if I could just make one final comment, the folks at Brookings are going to put up the 25 slides and. This group has had the good fortune of being able to analyze it for about the last 8 weeks. And due to my very scientific analysis, I figured out that 1 out of 7 attendees here is either from the MSRB or the SEC. So realizing that there's going to be full disclosure of same-day takedowns for essentially riskless principal trades, I think it's slide 24 or 25. Maybe you guys have it, but I've never seen it before. But it shows year by year the difference in essentially takedown between the institutional market and the retail market. And it's just fascinating data that these guys have. And if you have it, I've never seen it before, but I would certainly take a look at those slides for everyone out there. It was just great work on their part.
Yeah, and it is the intent of Dan and Marty to make their data available to folks that want to play around with it, and they're more than happy to look at collaborations with other academics that want to do some further research at some of those charts. Each chart could be its own research topic. So, I want to thank Dan and Marty for that great work that went into this presentation and the rest of the panelists and for everyone's attention. We have a 15-minute break, and then we move into our breakout session. So thank you very much.
All right, I think we're going to get started. Thank you, everyone, for coming. Thank you to all the august organizations that are sponsoring today's events. Thanks for having us here. I also was supposed to make a public service announcement that there are plenty of seats up front, so all you recalcitrant individuals in the back, if you want to come forward and be closer to the knowledge that's about to be shared. I'm going to do some very quick introductions. So Don Boyd is the Director of Fiscal Studies at the Rockefeller Institute. He is the co-author of numerous terrific papers on state and local government finances, including one that was released today that says that things are not looking so good for state revenues coming in below forecast in April and May. He was the executive director of the State Budget Task Force, which many of us know and love, a couple of years ago, with some really prescient warnings about things happening in our sector. He was the director of the revenue staff at the New York State Budget Division and the New York Assembly Ways and Means Committee. Louise Shaner is going to be discussing his paper. She's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and policy director of the Hutchins Center for, the Center for Monetary and Fiscal Policy. There we go. She was at the Fed for 20 years before that, but also was Deputy Assistant Secretary for Microeconomic Policy at Treasury, and she was a senior economist at the Council of Economic Advisers and has written widely on health spending and other fiscal issues. Danny Shoag is an assistant professor at Harvard's Kennedy School and writes on urban economics, political economy, and public finance, search behavior, and hiring. And he is the co-chair of something called HumTech, which I've never heard before, so that's kind of a cool thing. Byron Lutz is chief of the Fed's fiscal analysis section and writes extensively on state and local finance issues and has top publications in a number of journals. Richard Boylan is professor at Rice University. He has a PhD from Caltech and similarly writes in law, economics, and political economy. And Nancy Winkler was Philadelphia treasurer from 2011 to 2016. She was an early member of the Public Financial Management Group and managing director there, and she has been on GFOA's debt committee. So, yes. Oh, and Yiming, I'm so sorry. I thought there would only be one presenter. Yiming's a co-author who also will be presenting. He's a research associate at the Rockefeller Institute at SUNY Albany. Thank you. So we have some excellent papers, and we have excellent comments, which I have already seen. And two of the papers are on the pension funding gap. So we basically have a $2 trillion difference between the obligations that state and local plans have incurred and the assets that they have on hand, according to the Federal Reserve and the Bureau of Economic Analysis. Andrew Biggs has referred to this as a quadrilemma. So you basically have this impossibility theorem, or the impossibility of assuring high return, stable contributions, low contributions, and stable costs across generations or intergenerational equity. So the first two papers are going to discuss that problem. And in fact, they're so similar to each other that I actually thought I was reading the abstract for one paper when I was reading the abstract for the other paper. So I'm really glad that we'll have a chance to sort of compare assumptions and results. And then the third paper is about basically how did we get into this mess, or the political economy of pensions among other issues of spending at the city level. So we're going to start with Don and Yiming. Which order? I'm not sure who's going first. Don first. And I'm going to invite actually all of the authors of papers to come sit at the table.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. We're really happy to be here and do our best to do a good job. I'm glad you mentioned Andrew Biggs' paper, because we actually owe a real debt to that. To anybody who hasn't read it, just search Quadrilemma, Biggs and Pensions, you'll find it. We always asked ourselves, are we doing something that he didn't do? And we think we've done some things that he didn't, but it's a good paper. And I got to find, is this supposed to be on? Let's see if I'm, all right, I'll talk for a minute while we're figuring this out.
Oh dear, I don't see it.
I think that would make sense.
Okay.
Yep.
And I'll get those. So, Danny, you want to go first?
All right. Is this okay?
Well, that doesn't really work.
How's that going to work?
No, don't do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
Do you want to talk without
slides? I'll start without slides, and then I'll tell you about a couple of the slides, but it will be hard without the actual slides. Okay. So, first, let me start with kind of what motivated us and what we're doing. Public pension plan assets now kind of round up to $4 trillion, 3.95 or something like that, in the latest flow of funds accounts. So there's a lot of money. They are underfunded now by $2 trillion, despite the contribution increases we've been seeing, certainly very substantially, for about a decade plus. And the investing environment has become much more difficult for these funds. So, good. As risk-free returns fell, and it's not in lockstep, but as risk-free returns fell, plans, for the most part, the public plans, by and large, maintained their investment return assumptions. So in this graph, just so you know, on the left side, the line heading down is the 10-year Treasury yield. The green line is a measure of private pension fund investment return assumptions. We're good. And the blue line is the what happened to public plan assumptions. So they've come down, but not much. Public plans are now much more heavily invested in equity-like investments than they used to be. Back in 1990, around 40% now, up around just almost 70%. So there's a lot of risk out there. And whether it's a good or a bad thing is something we'll have some discussion about. We wanted to evaluate the potential consequences of this risk because I'm trying to figure out how to work this. Am I going backwards? All right. Give me a second to figure this out. So we wanted to evaluate the potential consequences of this risk. Is hard. There's no single point estimate of what's going to happen to pension funds. So what we did is we built a stochastic simulation model. Many of you are probably very familiar with how they work. What we've done is we've constructed kind of prototypical pension funds. So the pension fund has demographic characteristics. In this case, we constructed a fund that looks kind of average. It's based on Arizona state retirement system, state employees retirement system. But we have other prototypes we look at as well and some real funds. So we construct a fund. It has a demographic structure. We give it benefit rules. We kind of forecast out the cash side, the benefit side, and then we impose funding policies, which Iman will talk about when he's up. And so we kind of create a life cycle for the fund year after year after year. It pays benefits. It receives employee contributions. It receives employer contributions. And it, most importantly in our model, it gets investment income. We constructed, typically we draw investment returns from a normal distribution. In most of what we talk about today, we use a 7.5% compound return and a 12% standard deviation. So that's kind of what we draw, which we think is pretty close to certainly what a lot of plans think on the volatility side and very much like what they assume on the return side. And we produce outcomes from that analysis. You have essentially 1,000 lifetimes of a pension fund. And then we create a distribution of those outcomes. They're usually somewhat skewed, like what you see there. So often you have lots of moderate outcomes and some very bad outcomes. There's usually a tail to it. So we did this. The whole purpose was to be able to investigate some of the questions about how much risk is there and what might it mean for state and local governments. All right, there we go. So quickly, I'd like to point out what I think is a really important thing. It's not a summary of the model. It's an example of some individual simulations. What you're looking at in these two graphs is on the left-hand side, we have the employer contribution rate as a percent of payroll. That's the graph on the left. And we have three specific simulations from our model. The red line is the plan earns exactly what it assumes every single year. The blue and the green lines happen to be simulations pulled from our results, just two simulations out of 1,000 pulled from our results, where in fact at the end of 30 years they hit their assumption on average. And to me, this is a really important feature of what we learn from the model, is that there is a roller coaster path, that all three lines on the left graph are employer contributions under a simulation that hits the plan's return at the end of 30 years. But you can be way up or way down. And the same is true on the right. Now it's funded ratio. Same basic idea. The takeaway from that to me is these are plans that are embedded within political systems. So you have to ask yourself, if I have contributions in that blue line on the left that are 50% higher, somewhere around the middle of 15 years, what are politicians going to do, right? So that's one issue that comes up with risk. And on the right side, you see that we have scenarios in which the plan becomes extraordinarily overfunded at some periods of time, even though, you know, it's kind of hitting its returns on average. So we're trying to, so as we show you some summary results, which all look much smoother than this, you should remember that they're summaries of 1,000 wild paths like this, and politicians are expected to behave in a way that keeps, nonetheless, sticks to the plan. So, all right, what am I doing wrong here? Yeah, okay. So one of the things we did is we looked at three investment return scenarios. We called them the good old days, invest in riskier assets, and maintain allocation and lower expected return. What we tried to do was kind of look at the situation that public plans faced as risk-free rates fell. And the good old days turned out to be very good in the way we did it, but they had a risk-free rate of 6.7%, a 1.8% standard deviation, and then invest in riskier assets, I would say, this is a pretty good characterization of where a lot of plans are now. And so risk-free rate fell substantially. The plan maintained its return assumption and had a 12% standard deviation. And the alternative was maintain allocation and lower expected returns. And let me just kind of get to the summary results, because I don't want to eat into Iman's time. So we have the top panel of this graph shows what happens to the funded ratio in the three scenarios. The good old days, you're looking at a 75th percentile of the funded ratio is the green line, blue is 50th, and red is 25th. Basically, under that scenario, there's not a lot going on with the funded ratio. It's not terribly volatile. On the right-hand side, way off to the right, is the lower assumed return scenario. And what we see there is, again, under that particular scenario, the funded ratio stays kind of very tight, and in fact becomes huge relative to the good old days. The invest in riskier assets is kind of where we are now, and with a much larger range of outcomes. I'm going to get to the bottom line, so I'm not going to go through the next table, so one can come up. The bottom line, the bottom panel shows employer contributions. What happens? Left side is good old days. They're pretty stable and kind of low. Invest in riskier assets. They are potentially high and potentially low, and I think that's a reasonable characterization of what's going on now. And had they chosen to lower assumed returns very dramatically, the right-hand side shows you, you know, kind of why they didn't, which is employer contributions in this case would have bumped up to almost 45% of payroll in our prototypical plan. That in the base case was more like 15%. So a tripling of contributions. We didn't do that. We're taking risk. Now we can talk about whether we've moved a little bit. The good old days were as good as we thought, but that's, I think, very much what's going on, and some interesting insights for our model. With that, Iman, you're up.
Okay. 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 Thank you, Don. I would say that public pension funds now face greater uncertainty in plan funding and employer contributions than before. But uncertainty is generally bad for governments because it can make budget planning more difficult. So various kinds of funding policies are used to dampen this kind of volatility in employer contributions. The choice of funding policies will determine how fast the investment shortfalls will be paid off over time. And actually, there is a trade-off in the choice of funding policies. So, sorry, I'm showing the wrong slides. Okay, so the funding policy that repays investment shortfalls very quickly will generally lead to good plan funding status and a better benefit security for beneficiaries and less burden for future taxpayers. But you also require higher short-term employer contributions. Funding policy that repays investment shortfalls over a long period of time will require lower short-term required contributions, and will make the contributions more stable over time. But the contribution stability comes at a cost of greater risk of severe underfunding in the future and the higher burden for future taxpayers. So in our paper, we use our stochastic simulation model to examine the funding risks and their different kinds of funding policies. So we mainly focus on four elements of funding policies. The first one is amortization method and periods, which determines how fast the recognized and funded liability is paid off. And there are three aspects of the aspects of amortization method, whether the method is closed or open amortization, whether the amortization payments are level dollar or level percent of payroll, and the length of the amortization period. And usually, amortization method with closed amortization method with level dollar payments and longer amortization period will have lower required employer contribution and pays off the unfunded liability more slowly. And the second element of the funding policy is asset smoothing, which works by recognizing the investment shortfalls incrementally over time. And asset smoothing can protect the plan sponsor from large increases in employee contribution and provide time for financial and political planning. And the third element is discount rate that is used in the calculation of actuarial liability and annual cost of the pension plan. And the higher the discount rate, the lower the calculated actuarial liability and the required annual costs. And the fourth element is the statutory rules that can override actuarially determined contributions. And we simulated various combinations of funding policies, but here we only report results for five selected funding policies. And the most stretched out funding policy is a 30-year open level percent amortization with 5-year asset smoothing. And the least stretched out funding policy is a 15-year closed constant dollar amortization with no asset smoothing. And there's a moderately stretched out funding policy in between. And we also examined the funding policy based on the Society of Actuaries Blue Ribbon Panel benchmark, which has a moderately stretched out amortization method, and more importantly, with a lower discount rate of 5.9%, which will make the plan under this funding policy have higher calculated liability and higher annual costs. And the graph on the left shows the risk of sharp increases in employer contributions, which is measured by the probability of employer contribution will rise by more than 10% of payroll in the 5-year period during this 30-year simulation period. You can see that the very stretched out funding policy has a very good, very strong smoothing effect on the employer contribution. So the probability is only less than 20% at year 30. And by contrast, the least stretched out funding policy under that policy, the probability is over 80% at the year 30. But under the most stretched out funding policy, the probability of a severe underfunding is much higher than other funding policies. You can see that it's around 17% under the 30-year open level percent amortization. And the probability under other policies are quite low. And you can see that under the SOA Blue Ribbon Panel-based funding policy, both of the two types of risks are very low, but this comes at a cost of higher required contribution in the first couple of years. Actually, the cost can be twice as high as the cost under the most stretched out funding policy. Okay, so the trade-off between these two types of risk can be better seen in this graph. The horizontal axis is the risk of sharp increases in employer contribution, and the vertical axis is the risk of severe underfunding. And we plot all the funding policies we have examined on this plot. We can see the trade-off between these two kinds of risks clearly here. And we have outliers there, which is the funding policy based on the SOA Blue Ribbon Panel benchmark, which has a higher discount rate and higher contribution rate. It's low in both types of risks, but the contribution required are also quite high. So we need higher contributions to make both types of risks low. So up to this point, the simulations we have examined are based on the assumption that the 7.5% return assumption can be achieved, but some recent market forecasts suggest that it can be difficult for public pension plans to reach that assumed rate of return, and some studies also show that in order for the pension plans to reach that level of assumed return, they have to invest even more aggressively, making the contribution volatility even greater. So to examine the consequences of the unexpectedly low return or unexpectedly high volatility, we constructed two alternative return scenarios. In the first one, the assumed return is due 7.5%, while the true expected return is only 6%. And in the second alternative scenario, the return assumption is still achieved, but the pension plan has to invest more aggressively, making the portfolio volatility 17.2%. And we can see that compared to the benchmark scenario, both types of risks under these two alternative scenarios are much higher. Okay, so I have a quick summary of the results. So the choice by most of the public pension plans to increase the investment risk has kept the governmental contributions low than they otherwise would have been, but also increases the risk of severe underfunding. And there is a trade-off between the risk of severe underfunding and the stability of contribution. And there's no easy way out of this situation. To de-risk, the pension plans have to invest less aggressively, and that will almost certainly increase the required contribution substantially. And given the size of the public pension system in the U.S. and the greater risk it faces, we need better analysis, reporting, and communication of risks in order to make better informed policy decisions on pension issues. Okay, that's our paper. Thank you.
I don't know if that's good enough. Anyway, hi, thank you very much. So first of all, I wanted to say thank you for this really interesting paper that really helps illustrate the trade-offs between risk and return in some real-world context. It was really nice to see, instead of just talking about, you know, what standard deviation is and stuff, just sort of thinking, like, what are good outcomes, what are bad outcomes, how likely are they to happen, when will they happen, what's the timing of that? And it's just a very nice way of communicating what risk means. And it also shows you the implications of different pension rules, this idea that you'll never get to full funding if you use this sort of constant amortization, even if you always make your return. Hadn't really thought about it that way before. It makes sense when you think about it, but it was really interesting, and I learned a lot from reading this paper. And like all good papers, it also raised some broader questions that I will get to and made me think, which is really great. Okay, so what my comments are going to focus on, there's a lot of things one can talk about in pension plans, but there's two really issues, which I'm going to start with. How realistic are the diagnosis of the problem and the scenarios that they use to demonstrate it? And then to go broader, should we actually take it as a given that plans should be 100% funded? What should they think about funding when ex ante, like when they're deciding how much to put in and they're doing the best assumptions they can? And how should they respond to shocks where their assumptions turned out to be wrong? And sort of more broadly, even, is just I do some state and local, but I've done a lot of federal work over my career, and it's just a really huge disconnect between the way we think about federal spending and budget and the way we talk about state and local and pensions in particular. In the federal, we acknowledge that there's uncertainty, but we always just sort of go through means and expected values, and there's a lot more focus on uncertainty at the state and local level, and it's kind of interesting. Okay, let's go to the diagnosis. So this is the story they tell, which is, in the good old days, pension plans could invest in safe portfolios and get high returns. Everything was easy. Everything was great. And private pension plans and public pension plans, private and public pension plans both did this, as they showed you, and I'll show you in a second again. And then interest rates fell, and public pension plans decided that to respond to the higher interest rates, they would increase their equity investment, so increase the risk in their portfolio, so they could keep their high rate of return assumption and not have to contribute more instead of lowering the rate of return. But private pension plans didn't do that. Private pension plans said, oh, we're not going to change our allocation. This was just the public plans doing this. And the implications for the public sector is this is not something that's been going on for a very long time. This is a direct response to the lowering of the interest rates, and it's a new issue, right? So I'm not sure that I'm convinced exactly completely by this story. So I'm just representing the picture that they showed you. So if you look, it's true from 1990 to about 2005, public plans and private plans moved together, and they both was this kind of increase in equity. So it wasn't just public plans that increased equity concentration. There was this long-term trend of both of them. And then what happened, I'm not sure why, in 2005, is that the private plans decreased their equity concentration. The public plans kind of stayed up there. So there wasn't this trend. Sort of, we've been talking about low interest rates maybe over the past, you know, 5, 7, 8 years. It's become sort of a big discussion. That's not when the big movement in equity concentration happened. It happened before. Okay. The other question is the way they characterize the good old days and now the new bad days. You know, I don't know if the good old days were ever that good. And I don't know if the bad new days are as bad as they are. So one of the things they talk about a lot is in terms of nominal rates of return. Now, one of the reasons nominal rates used to be high is inflation was high. But for a pension plan, if they're going to index their pension contributions to inflation, which they don't all do, but they mostly do even on an ad hoc basis, if not statutorily, then what you really care about real rates of return. And there's also different ways of measuring real rates of return. So the light blue line here shows you this 10-year Treasury real rate of return where I'm looking at actual inflation over the next 10 years, right? Not what they necessarily anticipated, but what actually happened. And so what actually happened is you did have this period of very, very high real rates in the early 80s to mid-80s, and that's because people didn't expect inflation to come down the way it did. Right, so they had these high nominal rates, thinking inflation was high, but inflation ex post turned out to be very low, and so real rates turned out to be high. The purple line shows, there's many ways of looking at inflation expectations and better ways than this, but I just did this very simple. What if inflation expectations were equal to the average of the past 2 years of actual inflation? And there you see a much less going up and going down to real rates, and even so, you still see these kind of patterns where when inflation came down, real rates went up. That was also, real rates did go up too. But anyhow, if you see it, there were some years where you got 6%, the way we used to talk about real rates where we think long-run real rates were about 3, and now we think they're like 1, or maybe 3.5 and 1, over extended periods of time. And so I think, that definitely real rates have come down, but the 4 percentage points that they use is kind of like at the high end of what I would say would be a reasonable description of what's changed in the economy. The other thing is the way the scenarios are constructed. In the good old days, treasuries are completely riskless, right? So all you have to do is invest in treasuries, and you're not going to have any volatility in your portfolio. But that's not true if, one, you don't exactly match your liabilities to the treasury because you have rollover risk. In fact, that's what happens. They were investing in treasuries, and all of a sudden rates on treasuries fell, and they couldn't actually, and then their portfolio took a hit, right? Or their fiscal situation took a hit. And also, they weren't looking at inflation index, which were not always available. And if you're not inflation index, then nominal rates, even if there's no default risk, still give you inflation risk. So I don't think that the old days were like there was no volatility, and so that those scenarios where they say zero risk on that portfolio, or if you just invest in a riskless asset, is exactly right. Okay. So the other part of these scenarios when they're comparing is I asked them actually because it wasn't in their paper and they helped me figure it out and I tried some other things too to figure out what was the share of equities in the portfolios when they go from the good old days to the bad new days. So in the good old days, the share of equities in a portfolio was about 12%, which as you saw was much, much lower than even in 1990. And then in this riskier asset, you have to get up to 83% of your portfolio in equities for this riskier days scenario. So the scenarios that they're showing you have a huge, huge change in the amount of risk in your portfolio. And that's using an equity premium that's quite high at 6.5%, which is higher than most people think. If you lower the equity premium, then the only way to get the outcomes that they have in that riskier asset is going to be something closer to, you know, 100% equities. So not to say that these aren't instructive. I think they're very instructive and they're in that direction. But the magnitude of the differences between those scenarios, I think, overstates the magnitude of the changes that we've seen over time in the economy. Those are the takeaways I take. I'm not going to read them again, but from the paper. And now I want to go to broader issues. So I want to think about pension plans within the context of state and local budgets. And actually, Colin McNaught was talking about that this morning, you know, to think about getting out of the silo of the pension plan, which I thought was interesting. So if labor markets are competitive, then employee compensation is not affected by pension funding. They're going to get it. They're guaranteed. So really, they're not bearing the risk. So what the pension plan funding decision is really about a funding of the timing of government spending and, in some sense, government debt. Because even if you can't borrow explicitly, underfunding your pension plan is a way of basically borrowing from the future, right? And so we want to sort of think about the decision of how much to fund your pension plan in the context of the bigger decisions you have about state and local expenditures and revenues over time. So, you know, and I think there's a parallel between the Social Security Trust Fund. Economists never look at the Social Security Trust Fund except for as a political economy question, which it might get people to move. But that we like to think of the federal budget as a whole and the fact that one piece has assets and one piece has, you know, debt. Well, we just kind of put them together. And I think, as we were talking about this morning, that you want to think about your portfolio of assets together as a state and your expected liabilities, your expected expenditures over time together. And I think when you do that and you don't think of just the pension plans, oh my God, they might run out of money, but you think more broadly at the state level, well, then you also have this taxing capacity. You have capacity of cutting spending in other ways. And then I think the equity risk is a lot less daunting. I mean, you know, equity is risky, but we all hold it in our portfolios because we, you know, and we can also say, what's the probability that we're going to, you know, be retired and have no money? And, you know, it's not zero. But we still think that equity investing is worth it. And so I think you sort of think in the more broader context, okay? Another question is, should states fully fund ex ante? It's sort of taken as a given that, of course, they want to fund ex ante because, so the paper says, pre-funding helps achieve intergenerational equity. You don't want future taxpayers paying for, you know, the wages of current government workers. But, you know, when you think about state and local governments, I think a lot of what they spend money on is actually an investment, even in their non-capital budget. They spend a lot of money on education, environmental cleanup, assistance to kids. Those are things that when you spend money on, you actually bear the returns over a long period of time, and therefore it makes sense to borrow at least partially for that. And partially you're funding your pension plan is like partially borrowing to fund your current expenditures. Also, you know, there's a huge benefit to not cutting back on expenditures during downturns. And one of the big problems that we had in the last recession was this huge hit on the state and local sector, the slashed employment, and really had bad effects from a macroeconomic perspective. So keeping this very sort of strong, it has to be fully funded and not thinking about the broader context of what are you spending on the money on if you don't fully fund or not raising taxes or you know, and what are the benefits of that, I think, is really important. Another question is, okay, so a lot of the story was about a decline in interest rates. So how should states react to a decline in interest rates? It is interesting that from the, you know, from a federal perspective, a declining interest rates is great because we have this huge national debt and so then we have less interest. But from a state and local perspective, they have net assets and so they have a bad income effect, right? So there's two effects of a change in a price. There's an income effect and a substitution effect. The income effect is bad. It says, you know, you're worse off, okay? And that says, yeah, you should lower consumption, lower spending, and increase savings. But there's also a substitution effect, which just says it's very expensive, you know, to borrow from the, to save. I mean, you don't get much for your saving when interest rates are so low. So for some, from an economic perspective, and you're trying to decide what is the intergenerational debt burden, you might say, well, when interest rates are low, we're going to have a little bit more consumption now. And yes, stick it a little bit more to future generations just because that trade-off, those prices have now changed. So whatever we had before in some kind of intergenerational transfer, we should sort of move it a little bit, you know, and not fully offset the decline in interest rates. Okay. Let's see. I'm running out of time, so this is not really all that interesting. I'm just going to talk about, I mean, it's interesting. It's all interesting. It's basically very similar, which is just like, you know, how do you adjust to debt, to shocks? If you think, well, I'm a social planner, you might spread the effects of shocks over a long horizon. And the only other point I wanted to make is just, what about other sources of uncertainty? We focus like crazy on sort of uncertainty in pension plans, but if you think about all the uncertainties in a state and local budget, you know, tax revenues are extremely uncertain. Healthcare costs, we know, is really, really uncertain, a really huge part of budget. Just there's so much uncertainty, and we focus only on one part of it. And as I said, for federal governments, we don't even think about uncertainty at all. So maybe it just means we should take uncertainty more seriously in other parts of the budget. But, you know, from a policy perspective, we're never quite sure what to do about the uncertainty. We know it's there. But maybe we also worry about it too much for pensions because we focus on that and it seems larger than, it seems like the biggest thing, but maybe that's just because we don't really think about it in the broad context. I mean, maybe state and local governments are much more subject to Medicaid uncertainty than they are to pensions, and we should be thinking about it that way. Thank you.
Great. Thanks so much for having me. I'm Danny Schoeg. This is joint work with Jim Farrell, who unfortunately couldn't be here today for a family medical situation. But I'm really excited to present. And this is, like it was said, this is a very similar work to the work that Dan presented earlier. It's a little bit of a new for me because it's sort of more directly policy applied policy work than my usual academic stuff, but I've found it really interesting to work on. And the goal and is to try to create and simulate a realistic model of pension plan dynamics. And the target is that, you know, a lot of pension accounting, or at least reporting, is pretty deterministic. We don't really get a good sense of the distribution of risks or outcomes. And when we do get reporting, it's not easy to compare across funds because the numbers that get reported accumulate a lot of assumptions that might differ across places. So the goal is to build a model that can be used to overcome some of these challenges, and hopefully it's work that could be used by others, and maybe it's we can integrate the small bits of mine that I might contribute over and above the great stuff that you guys have done. So what I'm going to try to do quickly is just motivate the exercise and so show some baseline simulations, and then think about the impact of a few policy choices on the distribution. And so, you know, this is something we've talked about before, but, you know, state and local pension plans manage an enormous amount of money, nearly $4 trillion in assets. This number is actually a little bit lower. The last time I looked up in the flow of funds data, it's about 6% of U.S. corporate equities. It had been closer to 8% when I first looked up the number. You know, 2.25 to 2.5 times state and local tax revenue. And also, you know, it's responsible for many people's retirements, not just a lot of money, 20 million members and 10 million beneficiaries, and the promises are substantial, and the required outlays are growing. So to fund these liabilities, state and local governments have amassed a big pool of assets, and there's a debate about how big those assets are, and everyone in this room is familiar with that debate. Academics who've worked on this argue a lot of justification that the correct market value of these pension liabilities can be calculated using near risk-free rates, and a lot of the academic literature has sort of required what are the required contributions given those valuations. But I think many people who are, and you can obviously correct me, but many of the people who are in the world say, you know, this is what you're talking about is an academic argument, and truth is the discount rates that that are being used are may actually give you know, may actually be better at projecting what's going to happen. And so there's some degree of talking past each other, I think, in this literature, and neither is a great necessary guide for forecasting. You know, I think obviously this is important because the liabilities are big. But I think it's also, this is a figure I made for a paper and now it's now kind of out of date, but it's an important point. Because not only are the liabilities big, but the earnings from these plans have been really big too. So if you take, you know, we don't necessarily have annual investment returns, a data set going all the way back. But you can figure out, you know, if you start early enough, the plans are all pretty small. You can add up the money that's gone in, the money that's come out, and the money that's still left. You see that at least, you know, when I made this figure in 2008, the average stated earner maybe, you know, 8.15 to 20% of from the pension fund of total tax revenue over that period, right? So every 5 years of tax, the pension plan was kicking in a year of tax revenue, which is just an enormous sums. Some of the context has already been discussed, but I can contribute one little bit, which is some data I collected for when actually I was writing my dissertation. It's data on investment returns going way back. I sat there in the Library of Congress looking at CAFRs and writing out investment return data. So you can see, you know, that just, this was just to push the series a little farther back. What you can see is that the distribution of returns is not only very varied year to year, and that's some of the risk that we've been talking about, but there's a lot of variation within a year or two. And so what I'm going to focus on is trying to come up with a model for returns. So if we're going to think about this exercise as creating a realistic model of pension dynamics, a big, very important chunk of that is coming up with models, you know, draws of investment returns. And so I think that's maybe one piece where my work differs a little bit from the past work. And so I'm going to focus a little bit more on that, as opposed to the other stuff. So, you know, given this, the stochastic returns play such a large role, how should we think about the distribution of outcomes? How do policy changes affect that distribution? Can I make this code or model that's going to be publicly available allow you to vary things like asset mix and funding assumptions? This is a building off of some work by Josh McGee and Michelle Welch, and it's pretty similar to Dan's work. So again, I'm going to skip some of the detailed calculations of the pension accounting. If those of you are interested, you can read the paper. But I'll move on to the more interesting pieces, which is how do we model these returns? And so the first approach is to take a bunch of benchmark indices, take 30 years worth of data, and start our process by drawing 1 year. So you draw 1 year, and you start with the benchmark return for all of these asset classes in the year. And that preserves a cross-class correlations. It's pretty tricky to model that abstractly, and so we do that. Now, within a year, there's a lot of heterogeneity within asset classes. So the fact that I'm invested in equities doesn't mean I'll necessarily earn the benchmark return. And so using data on large DB plans, investment returns within asset classes, we estimated both a variance, and of course that variance is also cyclical. So it's not only that you might not earn the benchmark return, but your odds of winding up far below it may be worse in bad times. Okay, and so for the major asset classes, we'll actually let that variance, that plan-specific variance, be vary with the cycle. So we'll show you some calculations using the Texas ERS as our baseline system. Using the starting point, given their allocation, we have a distribution of returns centered around a little bit under 10.5, with standard deviation in skewness and kurtosis that seem right given the literature. Now, of course, this is a very large average return, right? It's a lot higher than this historical distribution that I just collected going back to the Library of Congress. Now, some of that's the different allocation, right? So Luis, you guys have talked about changing risky share, and so can't really compare to historical experience. It is quite a bit more favorable than recent experience, although recent experience may be atypical too. So the red line here is sort of the public plans data set, the cumulative distribution function of returns in the public plans data set. And the blue line is here, the simulated distribution that we recovered using, you know, longer time series. They have similar statistical properties, except there's a big shift, right? Because the public plans data set is not nearly as favorable. So getting the distribution of returns right is going to be extremely important for thinking about the risk inherent in, or the distribution of outcomes that you could get from public, from in one of these public plans. But you know, it's hard to know what's the right distribution. And they have big consequences. So you know, if the blue distribution is right, which is, you know, taking the benchmark indices and applying reasonable variation relative to that, it looks like the Texas ERS system will close its amortized payments and the shortfall, at least the mean, although there's a lot of risk, and that's what I'll talk most about. If you take the most recent public plans distribution, then you see that these payments actually go up instead of going towards zero. Now, you know, these are annual payments that I'm plotting here with the blue dots and the bars, and the bars are showing you the variance across different simulations. You can also think about taking a present discounted value of all these amortization and shortfall unfunded liability payments as a PDV of payroll. If we have the favorable distribution, these numbers are centered at a much more a much nicer point, somewhere around a mean of 24% for Texas of the PDV of payroll. But if you take the public plans distribution in recent years, this is much higher. Now, even if you, regardless of which distribution is right, there's a lot of heterogeneity even within given distribution. So there's a lot of uncertainty in that I don't know the right distribution of returns. But then there's also big, you know, big variance across outcomes. So the interquartile range in terms of the PDV of payroll here for these payments is about 10%. So you know, there's a lot of variance here in outcomes even within one of these distributions. And there isn't really a great statistic for sort of measuring or reporting these risks. There isn't a number that you can turn to sort of get the sense. You know, so if you think about some sort of thought experiment where you shift investments from fixed income to equities, like Dan was talking about, that's going to twist this distribution of potential returns, and it's going to shift this distribution of outcomes so that you get more favorable, you know, you have more weight at the very good outcome where payments are really low, but then you also build out a tail of payments where they're much higher. And there isn't really like a handy number, and so that's one of the reasons to build out these complicated models, is to give you some way of thinking about how asset allocation would affect this. Now, unfortunately, politicians can't just choose these higher returns, right? So the clear outcome is you should choose the more favorable distribution of returns. Unfortunately, that's not so easy to chew. But you can use this model to think about different policy choices. And so the two that I'll talk about really quickly, which I'm not sure are necessarily the most interesting, but are skipping actuarially required returns and then adjusting the discount rate. So why is skipping the actuarially required contribution interesting? Well, it happens, right? So between 2001 and 2013, about 85% of the amortized payments were made. And so you can throw into the model something where you skip your payments for 3 years and then you go back to making your required payment. So nobody makes the payment, and then this is the distribution of required payments. And this actually interacts with investment returns in sort of an interesting way. If your returns are really low, having skipped your payment up front is not so terrible, right? You avoided a couple years of terrible returns. Yeah, if the returns are really good, then it's actually also not so bad that you skipped it up front, because the plan will be funded anyway, unless you want to overfund the plan, and we can argue about whether or not that's good or bad. So it really actually it gives you this sort of interesting nonlinear impact, where the cost of skipping returns bites most when you're actually sort of in the middle of the return distribution. If the returns are terrible, you might wind up better off having skipped the return, skipped the contribution. And if your returns are really good, it's no sweat that you skipped the contribution. So, okay, maybe this is obvious, but we built a complicated model to find that out. Another policy choice you could think about is a changing discount rate. So, this is one where you know, having models like this is useful because, you know, perversely, if a plan raises its discount rate, it looks better funded at first, right? Because you've discounted the liabilities. You hold the assets fixed and you discount the liabilities at a higher rate. Well, you look better funded. And so instantly shifting from a 5% discount rate, which is what I think we had from Texas here in the brown, to a 7% discount rate automatically made the plan look better funded. Of course, over time, even with the higher discount rate on liabilities, the plan eventually looks worse funded. So these blue bars show that even using the 7% discount rate, the assets liability ratio shrinks. But using the model, we are able to come up with a liability adjustment factor, which you can apply to the numbers across plans. So it's a, you know, a little complicated formula that gives you a back of the envelope, a way of unskewing the differences in discount rates to get comparable measures across plans. And so, you know, this is a number we report in the paper, but it allows you to sort of undo these adjustments. And the chief impact of the discount rate relative to this unskewing is that it forces earlier contributions. In the end, you have to make the contributions anyway, but it works a lot like skipping the ARC. If you lower the discount rate, you're making contributions earlier, and so assuming that you're sort of in the heart of the return distribution, that adds to the total cost over time. But if the returns are really good or they're really bad, you might not be bad. You might not suffer so much from having a high discount rate to begin. Okay, so I think I got through things much more quickly than usual because I got to piggyback on comments that gave a lot of the context. But I think the current pension reporting is lacking because it doesn't really give you a way of reporting risk, and it's not really possible with the current statistics to compare funding status across plans. So if you download one of these data sets, it's hard for academics like me to use them because it requires adjustment to make it. To make it comparable. And so what we're trying to do here is, one, to create a model of pension dynamics with realistic shocks to be used for policymakers and for policy work, but also to give a way of scaling these things to make them more comparable. And I think when you build out this model, the big implication is that the reasonable range of outcomes within these plans is large. It's not to say it's large large relative to what? Large relative to, I think, in absolute dollars. So, there are lots of risks in the state system, but, if you think about the gains on these plans, they're big relative to state budgets. And so I do think there's something to think about here. It should allow policymakers to think about the impact on the distribution of outcomes and not just on individual moments. And there are some, I tried to give a little bit of a flavor, I think you can do more and look at more interesting policy responses, but the stochastic nature of returns can complicate the relationship between policy choices and the distribution of outcomes. So it might seem like skipping your required contribution necessarily creates bad outcomes, but it actually interacts with the distribution of returns in complicated ways. And so it's nice to have one of these models to think about how you affect the distribution and what those interactions look like. So thanks.
Right. Okay, so I need to start with this standard disclaimer, which is nonetheless very serious, that everything I express today is solely my own opinion and not that of the Board of Governors. So we're very lucky today to have two really nice, high-quality pieces of work that are really similar in terms of the topic and approach they take. And as a result of that, I'm going to use my discussion for most of it as an opportunity to do some nuts and bolts comparing of these two and see how they differ and why the different assumptions leads to different outcomes. But first, I want to make it clear that I think these are both really very nice contributions. On the academic side of this literature, the focus has overwhelmingly been on the liability side, but obviously the asset side is very important as well. And this is particularly important for mature plans where assets are very large relative to the available funding base. Cash flows have actually turned negative in many cases, meaning you're relying on the assets to fund current benefit payments. And a significant share of plan participants are retired and hence critically no longer contributing into the plan. In this type of situation, if you get a couple of years of negative asset returns, it's going to be very onerous in terms of your own resource stream to make up those assets or, in the worst case scenario, actually begin funding current benefit payments out of your revenue stream. Whenever I'm talking about the topic of pensions, I think it's important to realize that although the implications are quite obvious for individual government finances, as well as the retirees who are, you know, relying on this for their retirement, this really does have implications for the broader economy. Here we have a graph that many in the room may be familiar with. Here we have stacked bars that show the actuarial required contribution by year for pension plans. The blue part is what the employee needs to pay in order to cover the value of benefits earned that year. The yellow is the corresponding for the employer, and then the gray bar is the part that needs to be paid to begin working off the unfunded liabilities. And what we see here is that in 2001, using the discount rates assumed by the plans, which are of course controversial, plans were fully funded, and the contribution required in an actuarial sense was a very manageable 10% of payroll. But what we've seen over time is that this required contribution has really skyrocketed and is now well in excess of 20% of payroll, which is really onerous on state and local government budgets. And the thing to note about this is one way to think about what happened is over this period, asset returns came in annually about 1.5% below what plans had assumed, and that caused this absolutely, you know, massive spike in required contributions. Now, I was not trained as a finance economist, and I'm happy to admit that I would have naively assumed that falling 1.5 percentage points short per year would not be that big of a deal. But one of the big lessons of both of these papers is even very small deviations in assumed returns can have massive impacts over time. And the final thing to note, of course, as everybody in this room knows, the governments are not required to make the required contribution. But nonetheless, because the required contribution is obviously serving as a benchmark or a frame of reference, the black line shows what the governments actually did. They've made a massive effort to ratchet up their contributions in terms of payroll. We can see this here. We have actual employer contributions over a 15-year period on a nominal basis rising 9% per year over a period in which the tax receipts to fund those were only rising by 4% per year, right in line with nominal GDP growth. At the same time, the growth in expenditures on core government services, much of which is investment for the future, was really sluggish. We see workforce, a lot of teachers in here, hardly grew at all, and construction in many years struggled to even keep up with inflation. And while there are many factors behind this, undoubtedly the need to really ratchet up contributions to the pension fund because of the shortfall in asset returns is a part of the story. Another thing I really like about the papers is that they're very policy relevant in that they tend to give metrics which are understood in the annual stress in terms of the percent of payroll that will be placed on the government budget. This is going to be very easy for policymakers to understand. Much of the academic literature deals in, you know, unfunded liabilities as a stock, which I think many people struggle to get their heads around what that actually means in practice. Another nice aspect about these papers is risk is very difficult to think about, yet the papers provide very accessible results. Many of the results, you know, you can actually look at if these policies are pursued and the assumptions, you know, are valid, then there's a 1 in 4 chance you will get this outcome, a 1 in 4 chance you will get this outcome. It's just very tangible. And finally, as we saw Dan do at the end, there's a lot of nice counterfactual exercises that can be done with levers that policymakers can actually pull. And that has very interesting interactions with risk, such as the nonlinear interaction when you skip contributions for a couple years. So I'm now going to just jump into discussing a couple of places where the papers differ a bit. Just because I think it's useful. You know, I learned a great deal by reading these papers back to back, and it just sparked some thinking about the differences. I think without any question, the key difference between these two papers is the different
assumptions over the likely future distribution of asset returns. The Farrell and Shoag paper, as we've heard, uses annual data over about a 30-year period to construct what is really a wonderfully nuanced baseline distribution of asset returns. And it has a number of really nice features. Correlation in returns across asset classes. It allows individual pension funds who hold given assets to actually have variation relative to the benchmark in that year. And it captures the thick tails of the asset return distributions, the fact that you tend to get some extreme realizations relative to the average. The Boyd and Yin paper assumes a normal distribution and uses a mean and variance, which are very reasonable and consistent with plan assumptions and past studies. Now, I have to say that in principle, the Farrell and Shoag approach just has a lot to recommend it in terms of realism, nuance, and some of the counterfactuals it's going to allow. For instance, you know, they actually have the ability to change the asset mix being held by a plan and see how that changes outcomes and how risks affect the plan. At the same time, I have to say I do worry, though, in practice that the Farrell and Shoag assumptions may be a little bit overly optimistic in the sense that they're pulling from a 30-year period over which the risk-free return on assets has been trending down very steadily. Some of this has obviously transmitted into the returns on the riskier set of assets that the pension plans hold, and this may make such a long window inappropriate. And the paper is very upfront about this, and the presentation was as well. But you end up with a situation here where the Boyd and Yin paper end up with return assumptions, an 8% mean and a 12% standard deviation that are actually quite similar to what's reported in the Boston College Public Plan database. But the Farrell and Shoag paper end up with, you know, what's in essence a much more favorable distribution, lower variance and higher return. And the difference this causes in results, to me, was very surprising. So the Farrell and Shoag paper ends up with what I think I would term a pretty rosy scenario. You know, so what the graph shows here is how much the government needs to pay each year in amortization cost to work off the unfunded liability as a percent of payroll. And what we see in the median case, you know, by year 15, there's no unfunded liability left at all. And what's striking to me is even at the upper end of the gray area, at the 75th percentile, where you have gotten asset returns well below what you expected, you still worked off the liability a lot, and the stress on the budget, in a sense, has really receded. The Boyd and Yin paper comes to a much more, I would describe, pessimistic assessment. For virtually the same scenario, they find very little funding improvement at the median over a 30-year horizon, which contrasts to completely working it off in 15 years. And this just highlights how crucial the choices over the asset return distribution are. So I think the thing I would encourage both sets of authors to do more than anything, I really wanted to see some more results with different assumptions about the asset returns. That's the thing that reading the two papers back to back really emphasized to me. So one thing that was interesting between the two papers was the amortization method. The Farrell and Shoag paper assumes a 30-year level percent payoff method, which is very generous. It means you're going to be working off the unfunded liabilities over quite a length of time. Very sensible if you're only going to choose one method. But the Boyd and Yin paper explores a number of different methods, all of which involve more conservative assumptions, which will allow you to work off the unfunded liability more quickly, and creates a benchmark where you're likely going to be putting in higher contributions. And I was surprised, and I think Louise referenced this as well, at just how dramatically different the results were depending on the method used. And to the extent that anybody's interested in enacting reform, I think the stuff in the Boyd and Yin paper really makes it clear that difference in the amortization method by setting different benchmarks may really be able to affect behavior. I'm almost out of time. The last thing I want to say is about the liability side. Now, both papers are heavily focused on the asset side. That's the topic of the paper. But it's also the case that both papers have very sophisticated machinery on the liability side, which, having done work like this myself, I know took an immense investment to get running. And I think both papers could leverage that. Both papers are basing their results on the cash flows on the benefit side from a single plan. But, of course, cash flows can look very different across plans. And I'm going to give two examples of this now, just from some work that I'm actually currently doing with Louise and Jamie Lenny, who is here with us today and deserves a lot of the credit for the two graphs I'm going to show. But I was very interested in knowing, with different demographics, different choices over pension reforms, and the resulting difference in cash flows, how does that interact with risk? And because I think both papers are well set up to do with this, I think it should be easy to do. So here we have, for the Texas Teachers Pension Plan, the black line is simply the total benefits they're going to have to pay out as a percent of payroll. And that's just a sum of the red line, which is the payments to retirees, to the blue line, which are current workers, and the pink line, which are new hires. This is a very stable plan in terms of the benefit requirements, just a very flat level percentage of payroll. Nobody here will be surprised to see that Illinois looks very different. They are going to have a rapidly upward spiking stress on their budget. And then because of some reforms that have been put in place for new employees, it eventually tails off sharply. What I'd be really interested in knowing is, how does this period of rapid increase in demands on the asset base in the early years when you're ramping up payments interact with risk? What happens if you get hit with a couple bad years of asset returns right at that point? And I think there's some interesting things that, at least, you know, on the surface level, could be interesting. So I learned a great deal from reading these papers back to back, and I definitely encourage everybody to do so who has an interest in this topic.
Okay, since we're going to have sort of the switch, I think we should hold it to the end. Actually. Yeah, I think we should hold it to the end. Let's keep going. So, Richard, why don't you come out?
Okay, I'm Richard Boylan. I'm going to be discussing about the financial impact and the electoral impact of the Voting Rights Act. So first of all, I'd like to define what I mean by elections, Voting Rights Act, and financial impact. So by elections, I mean whether city councils are elected by district or at large. So if you're in a city where you vote for council by district, you only vote for that council member for your own district. If you're in a city where you vote at large, you vote for all council members. Here's an example of an at-large ballot. In this particular city, each voter would see exactly the same ballot, would pick at most three names, and the three candidates with the most votes would be elected to the council. All model city charters have recommended that cities employ at-large elections. The last model city charter makes two exceptions. It says in some cases you may need to elect some council members by districts to ensure minority representation. And a second exception is there may be a court order that requires you to have all council members elected by district. So Voting Rights Act was enacted in 1965 to enable minorities to vote. Nonetheless, city councils remained all white in cities that had at-large elections. So starting in 1975, courts started ordering cities to have district elections. And then in 1982, Congress amended the Voting Rights Act to prohibit any voting laws that had a discriminatory effect. And this led to even greater number of district elections. And prior studies have shown that courts were more likely to enact district elections if the jurisdiction had a history of voter discrimination. In the study, voter discrimination could be measured by percentage voter turnout in a 1964 presidential election. Okay, so this is a description of Philadelphia's districts. And so the point of this comic is that the districts in Philadelphia all represent particular special interest. And so this is why the economists refer to the common pool problem, which is all members of the council that is elected by district are going to care about particular special interest, and there's not going to be anyone there left to care about the benefits of the city as a whole. So one would predict that district elections would lead to higher non-infrastructure spending as all council members try to bring benefits to their own district, and less infrastructure spending since no one cares about making sure that all the infrastructure is repaired for future time periods. Okay, so the hypothesis I have is that civil rights led to the Voting Rights Act, which led to district elections, which affected city spending. And so I'm going to acknowledge the elephant in the room, which is it's possible that civil rights had a direct effect on city spending rather than an effect on city spending mediated by electoral rules. And so I'm going to provide three types of evidence that the effect is through elections. I'm going to be going through an event study, regressions, and matching. Okay, so in my event study, I'm going to split cities into four groups, depending on whether the entire council was elected at large between 65 and 74 or not, and whether the jurisdiction had a history of voter discrimination or not. So my treatment group are going to be the cities that had all at large council members and a history of voter discrimination. So those were the target to the 1982 Amendment of Voting Rights Act. I'm going to take as the control group cities that had all at large elections, but did not have a history of voter discrimination. So in the next graph, I have for each of these four groups and each year, I have the percentage of the council elected by district for each particular year. And so as you can see, there's not much going on except with the treatment group. And as you can see, for the treatment group, the percentage elected by district increases drastically between 75 and 92, and then it's pretty much constant. So I can restate that by let's just compute the difference between the percentage of council elected by district in my treatment group minus the control group, then this difference increases drastically between 75 and 92. Similarly, I can compute the difference in per capita real spending in my treatment and my control group. And what I get is the following graph. And so again, there's this one line that where a lot goes on. And what is this line? That's the difference between non-infrastructure spending in my treatment group and my control group. And so the implication I'm trying to make is that the change in electoral rules led to this drastic increase in non-infrastructure spending. And if the other line is infrastructure spending, which looks like it's going down over the same time period. Of course, the obvious pushback is what's happening. It's not being led by the change in electoral rules, but what's happening is being led by the original Voting Rights Act that allowed more people to vote. So the next graph, I'm going to be looking at turnout in mayoral elections to see if there are changes in voting, whether these changes in voting can explain changes in city expenditures. So in this graph, I'm most interested in the red line. The red line is voter turnout for my treatment cities. And so the way to interpret this, like this particular point right here, there, that we interpret that is 1960 in my treatment cities, voter turnout was 20% lower than in the treatment cities in other years. So that's not surprising. Before Voting Rights Act, people were not voting, at least minorities were not voting very much. And so what we see from this graph is that voter turnout in treatment cities increased drastically between 1676, then it's constant, and then it goes down. So the punchline is the pattern of voting does not match the pattern of spending. The next thing you might say, well, maybe it's civil rights as a whole, forget about voting rights, which are explaining sort of city expenditures. So my blue lines, I have measures of residential desegregation. So what one can see, and again, it's the difference between residential segregation in my treatment cities minus the controls cities. And one can see from the blue lines is that the cities with a history of voter discrimination are getting somewhat less discriminated, but the effect is not that strong, and it occurs, tends to occur mostly before 1970. So the pattern of residential desegregation does not match the pattern of city spending. So then one can look at school desegregation orders. So that's my line in green. And so what one sees is for my treatment cities, lots of school desegregation orders right around 1970. Again, the pattern does not match the one of city spending. Okay, then what you would want me is to draw the same graph with, say, white guilt. I don't have a good measure of white guilt, but you say if white guilt is leading to higher city spending, one would expect also that white guilt is also leading to more state spending for the states that these cities are in. So I'm going to run exactly the same graph, except I substitute for each city the spending in that particular state that contains the city. And what I find is that a relation with state spending is like totally different. It's state spending in my treatment cities, and it's not infrastructure spending, is decreasing during the entire time period. So none of these explanations seem to match the data as well as to the change in electoral rules. Okay, so one can formalize this by estimating regressions. So I have 88,000 observations. So an observation is a particular city year. And my variable of interest is how the elections are occurring, a large or by district. And I have all sorts of controls. Including the controls, I have year and city fixed effects. What do I mean by that? Instead of, say, looking at spending in Philadelphia in 1990, I'm going to be looking at spending in Philadelphia in 1990 minus the average spending in Philadelphia over all years, minus the average spending among all cities in 1990. And by doing that, I can eliminate any idiosyncrasies in the way we measure spending in Philadelphia or in 1990. So once I do that, the result I get is that changing from a large to district election raises non-infrastructure spending by 5 to 6%, has no effect on infrastructure spending, and therefore the share of infrastructure spending in city budget goes down. Next, I'm going to try to reestimate these results using comparable cities. So the way I make the cities more comparable is I'm just going to look at cities that have all the large elections between 65 and 74, and I'm only going to look at 2 years, 1977, 2002. So my variable of interest is going to be the growth in non-infrastructure spending over those 2 years. I'm also going to split cities into three groups. The first group are going to be the cities that could be affected by the Voting Rights Act. The second ones are the ones that are not, because they were going to switch to district elections for other reasons. There was also some corruption. Whites feared that that minorities were going to become the majority. The ruling political party feared it was going to become the minority. So they all decide, let's switch to district elections, because when we're out of power, we'll have some measure of power. And then the third group of cities, or I mean this group of cities that never change electoral rules. So you're going to ask me, how could it be that a city does not change electoral rules, even though the voting, the rights is enacted and trying to force them to? Well, they may have judges in their district that are not very favorable to the Voting Rights Act, or minorities are spread throughout the cities, so district elections do not help minority representation. So, strong assumption, one can estimate how many of these cities there are and what is the growth rate in non-infrastructure spending in these three groups of cities. So, the result is that 39% of cities are ones that can be influenced by the Voting Rights Act. So, of those, a fraction of those will have had a history of voter discrimination, and hence they will be forced to change to district elections. If that occurs, the prediction is that non-infrastructure spending will increase by 38% between 77 and 2002. Some other ones will not have had, So 30% are the ones that do not have a history of voter discrimination and hence do not have to change electoral rules, and so they stay with a large elections. Apologize. And then there's another fraction which had a history of voter discrimination and so will be forced to change to district election, and for those cities, spending grows by 54%. The second group are the group of cities that never they change electoral rules, but for other reasons. And I find that there are 19% of cities that sample in that group, and that spending grows by 47% for those cities. And then there's another group of cities, which is 42%. And for those cities, I find that non-infrastructure spending grows by 47%. In conclusion, from this slide, I have one more conclusion slide. If I want to look at the impact of district elections, I'm comparing an average of these three groups of cities when they have district elections to an average of these group of these cities when they have a large elections. And that gives me the impact of district elections. If I want to estimate the impact of district elections that were due to the Voting Rights Act, what I want to do is just look at the cities that could be influenced by the law and compare the growth rate of the ones that kept the large elections because the Voting Rights Act did not force it, because it was looking at historical discrimination, and the ones that were forced to. And so one gets a much larger impact of the Voting Rights Act on non-infrastructure spending. In conclusion, so my hypothesis was the Voting Rights Act led to district election, which leads to a lower share of spending that goes into infrastructure. So the only controversial implication is the last one, which is district elections lead less to spend on infrastructure. And what I provided is three pieces of evidence for why that's the case. The first piece of evidence is historical. So what do we mean by historical? There is one of the largest parts of discussion of cities has to do with municipal reform. And what this literature says is that having a large election leads to more infrastructure spending. The second piece of evidence was economic theory, which is district election lead to a common pool problem. And then a third piece of evidence was empirical evidence provided in this paper.
Hi, now for a complete change of pace. I'm the only non-academic and non-economist making a presentation in this session. And those of you who've heard me speak before, because I think there are a lot of people in the room who have heard me speak before, you know I normally use slides, and I normally speak without looking at notes. I don't have slides today, and I will be reading from my notes, and that's partly because this is a topic that I think I have to be very careful about, and it's also that I don't have a staff anymore to do all of those great analyses that I used to present. I would like to make a couple of just a broad comment that I think this has been an interesting panel. All three of the papers have been very, very interesting, and I have learned a lot in participating and reading the papers. I feel like I could talk forever about a lot of the points that were raised, I regret that I won't be able to. Let me turn to the paper itself. And first, let me say that I am going to be commenting on the paper, not on the presentation. And the paper has more in it than what was presented. And so, for those of you who have not read the paper, there may be a little bit of a disconnect. But hopefully, I'll ground my comments by making reference by quoting the paper. The author indicates in the paper that the minority's increasing exercise of their constitutional right to vote since the passage of the Voting Rights Act and the related increase of district representation has caused a decrease in infrastructure investment, which is what was presented. But it also, and importantly, correlates this directly with an increase in pension benefit payments. So my comments on the paper question the premise or theory that is being tested. The choice of such a limited set of markers, pension benefit payments, and infrastructure spending to serve as proxies for municipal fiscal health. And then I raise some granular questions about the choice of data to test the theory. So what is the theory supporting this hypothesis? To link an outcome to the Voting Rights Act requires a theoretical linkage to be secure, defensible, and sound, data-driven, and not ad hoc. The paper posits a theory that minorities, because overall they are poorer than whites, and these are things that are said in the paper, and have a higher probability of renting than their homes than whites, do not care as much about whites as the long-run fiscal viability of their city, and that they do not invest as much social capital as whites. And further, that these minority voters care less about the infrastructure of their city than whites because they can move easier and that they care more for current services as measured by pension benefits. The paper discusses certain civil rights periods initiatives, including Brown versus Board of Education, the Civil Rights Act of 1964, the Fair Housing Act of 1968, and the Voting Rights Act. So while reading it, I felt that the word minorities was primarily referring to African Americans. But I should note that there are only a few references to African Americans. Most of the language refers to minorities. So let me acknowledge first that the paper does present data that shows shows a correlation between Voting Rights Act imposed district elections and infrastructure spending in a year and pension benefit payments. But correlation does not equal causation. Now let me turn to the choice of selecting pension benefit payments and infrastructure spending in a year as the basis of comparison over a time series. In the introduction, the paper asserts the following, and this serves as the theory that's infrastructure investments use current resources to provide future benefits, while pension benefits represent the opposite. Employees provide benefits to current residents, but part of the employee's compensation is shifted to the future. So this is the paper's basic justification for selecting these two factors. I struggle with this basic premise of the paper for several reasons. But before I get into the granular discussion of why the choice of these two measures is problematic, we should consider how are fiscal spending decisions made in cities. Municipal funding decisions, which by their nature include a set of fixed costs that exist when a budget must be prepared. There are a set of fixed costs that would include debt service costs, the current payroll. So often when you're doing a budget, you have only a very small leeway to add services or shift the service delivery. So it's that initial mix of fixed costs versus discretionary spending. The interplay between federal, state, and local policies with changing social values. There are many factors that impact city budgets, including but not limited to national policy matters, and this, I'm sort of trying to identify ones that were during this time series that affected either infrastructure spending, current spending, or infrastructure spending. So we had the end of the federal grants funding of the wastewater treatment facilities. We had, lost my place here. We had the loss of federal revenue sharing at the start of the Reagan era. The focus of the federal transportation funding on new START projects rather than on the maintenance of existing infrastructure that really is often what is really needed in cities. The increased federal and state mandates, all of which may impact certain cities differently given their composition. Other factors include the intergovernmental system, the underlying economic and fiscal system, and the citizens' demand for services, and the local political culture and demographics. Remember, the data that's being presented is on per capita data over time, and there is an issue of how did the population in those cities change over time. And that wasn't addressed. So I think, and the commentator that spoke earlier on the first paper made a point, and I also made the same point, which is that what are the competing needs for the complier cities? For example, are there greater public safety concerns? Public safety costs may be crowding out other expenses, including infrastructure. If this is so, it may be that spending on public safety is in fact a fiscally prudent step to preserve the community's appeal as a place to live and work, and thereby protecting the tax base and the long-term future fiscal viability of a city. The paper does not examine this kind of question. So now let us turn to the specific selection of pension benefit payments and infrastructure spending. The paper uses a point-in-time spending comparison each year between infrastructure, tracking increases in pension payments in a year versus infrastructure spending. And then it correlates the spending differences over time. I don't think this is the right measure. The first part of the assertion, infrastructure investments use current resources to provide future benefits, is not exactly how I see it. While cities do use some pay-as-you-go funding for infrastructure, the vast majority of municipal infrastructure investments are funded with debt, not current resources. While the principal repayment terms of municipal debt are governed by the federal tax code and state law, it is clear that the vast majority of infrastructure investments are funded over 15, 20, or even 30 years based on the useful life of the assets being financed, so that the trade-off proposed to test voter preferences is not such an immediate budgetary choice as I think was that analogy that was being drawn in the paper. So I think an analogy to think about more about what the level of voter support is for infrastructure spending might have been to consider, and would have liked to seen it consider, the track record of voter approval of referendums, bond referendums, to ballot initiatives authorizing debt issuance for infrastructure projects in the complier cities, and compare that to the other cities. So the second part of this assertion is that pension benefits represent the opposite. Employees provide benefits to current residents, but part of the employee's compensation is shifted into the future. Technically, this is correct. But as we all know, in a year that the municipality must make a pension contribution. The pension contribution consists of two components, the normal cost and the amortization of the unfunded liability. So in a year, the normal cost and the unfunded liability, you know, I'm sorry, excuse me. So that the cities are making that payment, but in practice, the annual pension payments are really the thing I think that are crowding out spending. And those annual pension payments, the big problem with the pension payments is the history of underestimating the true cost of the benefits that were promised 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. And so that instead of simply making the normal cost, which is, you know, the value of the benefits that are earned in the year in which the employee delivers the service, discounted by the assumed rate of return on the pension fund, in the later years of the study, the municipalities now are having to pay more and more amortizing the unfunded liability. So that's what hits the city budget, and that's what's crowding out expenditures. But that's not what was tested in the paper. What was tested in the paper were the benefits paid. And the benefits paid, oh, I'm almost out of time, so I'll skip on. I noted the per capita spending choice, and I wonder if the populations of the cities with less than 50% voter participation may have either increased less or declined faster over time, and then they were stuck with greater fixed costs in their budget per capita, which made it more difficult for them to then make any more infrastructure investments. So I would have liked to have seen that analysis. And I'm just skipping through some of the other things. I note that the municipal finance industry looks at a very broad set of factors to determine the fiscal soundness of a government, and these two metrics were not sufficient for the conclusions that were reached in the paper. You really need to look at a very broad set of measures, which I won't get into now. I think that the construct that the minorities don't care as much about infrastructure investment because they don't own their homes, they can move easier. I would say it's just the opposite, because they rely on affordable housing and low income and public housing. They have less ability to move because those housing facilities are almost always located within the city limits themselves. So I don't agree with that issue, that point. Finally, a word on the common pool problem. In order to pass any legislation, budget legislation, capital programs, you need at least a majority, and in some cases, a supermajority. So no one city council person can drive spending. And many major municipal issues, such as social issues and infrastructure issues, are citywide. And I can't tell you, I can't think of a single city council person that doesn't want to get their streets paved. So, you know, in conclusion, I do see a correlation. I'll acknowledge there is a correlation, but I think we need to dive a lot deeper and look at this much more closely. Thank you.
So let me invite the authors to come up and answer questions, and we'll take questions. I'll skip my prerogative to ask the first question because I think we're a little short of time. So Richard and Danny. Okay, question. Yes, George.
One quick comment on the last one. I was kind of shocked at the idea that there would be, at the assumption that there would be a correlation between what happened at the state level, what happens at the city level, because in a lot of these situations we saw white flight, and what happened at the state level happened exurban or suburban rather than inside the city. So I thought the correlation was strange. But my main point is on the pension side is I think the reports were fabulous. In theory, what I've tried to do is to get to the real world, and what my worry is right now is that that we're in a near Goldilocks investment environment on fixed income versus equities, that we're way into a recovery, even though it's been a slow one, that rates are low, that equity valuations are perhaps shockingly high, not bubble perhaps, but high. And what I worry is that we're already in an upper right-hand quadrant between bonds and stocks, and that if you get a recession or if you get more inflation, under a lot of scenarios, stocks and bonds are both going to behave in the same direction, and that there's more of a chance that direction is downward than upward from where we are today. So I was wondering if you have any thoughts or on that. I know I got away from the theory stuff, so I'm not sure that I...
Well, no, actually, I think you, at least with regard to our work, you talked about things that we're not at yet, okay, which is, you know, this question of non-normality and the breakdown of correlations in, you know, some kind of market break. Those are the kinds of things we want to incorporate. As Louise pointed out, we don't do asset class allocations right now. We will. Now, Danny is already there on some of that, so you might want to... not there yet.
We did try to build that into the model, and I think what Byron said is tricky is that you can look at those correlations, but if you're training it on sort of historical data, you've had a really good run, right? And so projecting forward is tough. What we can say is the recent experience has been a lot less favorable for plans, and so.
But in an environment where rates have come down and stocks have gone up, so that's one of the things that worries me.
Yeah, the pool of assets is really big, and the returns on those assets are a really important part of the
financial plan for these states.
So public service announcement, there's a little icon of a guy talking on these microphone thingies, and if we push that, then the microphone's open.
Thanks. No.
Dan.
Is this on? Can you guys hear me? So I don't know if what I'm about to ask makes sense conceptually, but the way that I would have thought about this exercise would be that you're estimating the expected return and then the variance and covariance of returns, and there's also estimation error in the expected return. Like, there's uncertainty around your estimate of the expected return, and so your view of the range of potential outcomes should also incorporate the uncertainty in the estimate of your expected returns, and that would lead, I think, to a wider distribution than what you have now. Does that make sense, that question? So you're assuming that you know the expected returns, which nobody knows what the expected returns are. Like, that's something after 300 years. Like, we have no idea what expected returns are.
Exactly. Yeah, we don't know the mean, and we don't know the standard deviation, and we pretend that we do, and we show enormous risk and at least in my opinion, enormous risk and variation if we knew those things. And so you're right. It's a lot. I think it's a lot bigger, but
it's a floor in some sense, a floor of the total risk.
Yeah.
The way we approached it was to use historical distributions, right, and to allow you to choose asset classes, so you can scale it or some way. But at some point, you have to take a stand, right? And so that's the way we approached it, was to do that.
So I want to exercise my moderator's prerogative to build on Dan's question. So if either of you was leader of the world, how would you modify reporting requirements to try to capture this kind of uncertainty that all your stochastic determinations have uncovered?
I don't know. So I do think that the kind of tools that we laid out are a step towards that. I do think that sort of the next step in the exercise is to pin down a few... useful moments. Like, we were looking at things graphically. That graphs convey a lot of information. Probably in practice, numbers are more readily or easier to use across plans. And so creating a few summary statistics based on the kind of distributions that we get would be a useful reporting requirement.
Yeah, I think they have to be simple and not too many and useful. It would be great if GASB would actually require some. You know, I've talked to them, and they have a very long planning period. So to the extent they even think about it, it's, you know, a decade or more in the future. But not too many and simple.
I thought I saw a hand on this side of the room. Yeah, Natalie. Wait, so, there's a mic coming.
So, you know, this is maybe more of a comment, but I'm interested in your thoughts, and I'm actually glad there's someone from the Federal Reserve in the room. But to my mind, I see paper after paper after paper that says pensions were funded before 2000, and then after 2000, things started to slip, continued to slip, and so on. The turning point, if you look at 01, was when the Federal Reserve policy shifted to open liquidity, lots of open liquidity after that, and never quite shut the spigot off, creating enormously volatility in the marketplace. And I guess if there was an opportunity for a dialogue for the Federal Reserve to understand the impact on state and local government pensions and on others of that kind of policy making. It's like the banks are okay, so to speak, but what about this big multi-trillion dollar issue? The comment.
Louise, since you're ex-Fed, do you want to take that?
Debate about how much should the Fed think about risk taking and on them. You know, I think that's right now not really part of their mandate unless it affects the macro economy, but it is something that's kind of considered and debated.
Sorry.
I had a comment about the first two papers that were simulating the funding status of these pension plans, which is that if the asset returns are very high and you get to funding ratios that are above 100%, there's certainly the risk that politicians would use that sort of overfunded status to sweeten the pot and basically make benefits more generous, in some cases retroactively. And we saw that at the end of 2000 when asset prices were at their peak, and we did see some of those changes. So I think it may be a realistic, it's hard to model in the way that you currently have, but it's certainly a risk that perhaps should be considered, that if asset funding ratios go above 100%, well, we'll see benefit changes and then they'll go down again. So that's just one observation on both of these papers. And then to Richard's paper, just one question, which is that when these changes happened from at large to, let's say, by ward or by region, the size of the council changes well, because there's some work which shows that larger councils tend to spend more than smaller councils. So at least that's one other factor that...
Yeah, so that's what something I control for, the size of the council, and that has no effect.
May I ask a question about the district representation? You have a, because so many cities are mixed between district and at large, so how does that work in a common pool kind of framework if it's not 0-1, if not everybody is voting district-wise, as Nancy was saying, that there's still a political game that has to go on, right, where you're the, even if you're thinking in a self-interested way as a district representative, you have to do business with people who are representing the whole city. So theoretically, what would you predict that means for spending when it's mixed like that?
That's a good question. I hadn't thought about it, so it's all safe.
The gentleman right there, sorry.
Thank you. On the pension presentations, which I really enjoyed, a couple of issues I didn't hear much about in the presentation, although I think they were touched on a bit in some of the discussion, and they cut in somewhat different ways. The first has to do with current and prospective changes in pay rates for municipal employees. After all, the payout from the pension is almost inevitably a function of final average pay. So if we have a period of relatively low pay raises over a long period of time. We've seen that, and there's a good reason to think that the share of compensation going to pay is also probably on the decrease. Then the amount that will have to be paid out when benefits are finally paid will not be as great as if we made an assumption based on historical patterns or something else. I just don't hear much at all in the discussions about the extent to which plans are well or poorly funded, about expectations about pay rates, although that surely is going to be a driver of how much needs to get spent. The second has to do with the size of the municipal workforce, because current contributions are dependent on how many people are now working for the municipality and how many will be working for it into the future. And to the extent that we've seen, certainly we've seen declines in that in the period since the Great Recession. Who knows what it will be in the future? But the combination of economic pressures and a desire to privatize, if that were to continue, operates to depress the number of employees and therefore, at least in the intermediate term, reduce the resources available to pay benefits in the intermediate term period. I didn't hear much about either of those, and I'm not sure if that's because the authors don't think either of those are important, and I'm prepared to hear that, or I'd like to hear what they think about it.
So I do think that's a really important. I didn't talk much about it here. Modeling out can be quite difficult. We wound up having to use a shortcut that was a little too much to discuss in the 20 minutes, but having, in our scenario, we had the workforce growing, but at whatever the moderate rate was assumed by the plan, I'm happy to talk offline about what numbers look like if we change that. It does make a difference. So you're right to point out that that's something was undercovered.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly do model different kinds of workforces. Everything we presented today was stable workforce. We do look at growth like 2% a year, decline 2% a year. I would say that none of those approach investment return assumption errors in magnitude. I don't know, Iman, you want to talk say anything more about we have the capability to examine different salary growth rates than, say, what is embedded in an actuarial assumption. We haven't done it yet, mostly because my intuition is it's not big, but it belongs on the list of things we look at, along with mortality improvements greater than expected as well. But it's kind of because the number one thing seems to be investment returns in terms of risk.
I think we have time for one more question. And Louise, you had your hand up a second. Mark.
This is really as much as a comment. I keep thinking about the infrastructure versus non-infrastructure spending, and I just want to point out that when we try to explain those differences, at least in Kansas City, where I was, infrastructure spending is almost always funded with debt, and debt requires often state government approval and a supermajority vote. It's a lot easier to spend money non-infrastructure than it is to spend money on infrastructure. There are several more hurdles that you have to jump.
Okay, I think that takes us to the end of our time, but I think we've come away with a very nuanced picture of all the things that contribute to fiscal health of a community, infrastructure and non-infrastructure. So thanks very much for joining us. Thanks for your questions. I'm sorry we couldn't get to more of them. Thank you. Thanks to our speakers.